Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Music and Spinner.com, where you can get free MP3s, exclusive interviews, and more. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 213 for September 21st, 2009. The Dog in the Bookcase. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by GoToMeeting, the affordable way to meet with clients and colleagues. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com/twit. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twit. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, the show that covers all of your favorite technology topics, roughly in order, but mostly not. Joining us today in studio, Mr. John C. Dvorak, the real Dvorak. And by the way, the real Dvorak, not real Dvorak, the real Dvorak on Twitter.
Right.
And we're going to, David Pogue is going to join us at the end of the show. We're going to.
And Channel Dvorak.
And ChannelDvorak.com.
And also the real blog. Well, I don't do the Channel Dvorak or the real blog, but they are approved.
But we, before the show began, recorded an interview with David Pogue. He wanted to respond to the criticisms that he got last week from the TWiT panel and even kind of the week before. And he did so, I thought, well. But he included you in the criticizers, and it turns out, and I'll make sure David learns this, that he was reading a spurious Dvorak tweet.
A fake.
It was reading, well, we won't even give it out. I don't want to give him any publicity. But somebody with a mere 200 followers, you have far more.
60,000.
Okay.
Although it could be millions now that I think about it.
So anyway, we'll talk to David. He will get his chance to respond to what we talked about last week in terms of conflict of interest and the issues about how he talked to Steve Jobs and so forth. Also joining us this week, we have a international cast. I'm very thrilled about that. From France, Patrick Beja. He does a number of podcasts in France, including one that I keep meaning to be on, the Phileas Club, and never managed to get on. Patrick, what
it
is the...
It would be great to have you on.
I'd love to come on. It's frenchspin.com. Is that the place people should go for your podcasts?
Absolutely. frenchspin.com is the site. And you can find all of the different podcasts over there, both in French and English.
The Phileas Club is in English.
Yes, absolutely.
And combines journalists from all over the world to talk about... It's very much like an international TWiT.
We it's an international sort of general news TWiT, political and general topic. And we try to get opinions from really different people. Like we have a regular contributor from Saudi Arabia, and we try to get people from the U.S., South America, et cetera, et cetera.
Excellent. So. I look forward to it.
What's the website?
Frenchspin.com. And I bet you they'd like you on that Phileas Club too, John.
Sounds like it's on at the wrong hour.
It's late at night. Speaking of late at night, it is almost midnight in the UK. But that hasn't stopped John Graham coming from joining us, an old friend and a man I would like to honor on TWiT today.
Wow.
John, it's good to talk to you.
Well, it's very nice to be here. You know, he's a little bit late, but I'm a programmer, so this is actually, you know, normal working time.
That's true.
Past 11.
That's right.
Night, so.
That's right. Just imbibe more coffee. John is
more
the,
coffee, and then get up early or get up late as possible.
Right. Sleep in. That's the problem. That's the hard one, isn't it? Because tomorrow's Monday.
That is the hard bit. Yep.
So, John, I first met John, I think, during the Screensavers days. He wrote a really good anti-spam, open source anti-spam Bayesian filter. Called Popfile, which is on, I think, not just Windows, but Mac and Linux too, yes?
Yeah, it's written in Perl, and it was done completely cross-platform. I know it's even been run on things like an Amiga.
Wow. John, you'd like
yeah,
that.
That wasn't me.
You know, I still have one of those.
He still has an Amiga, yeah.
Gotta get rid of it.
So the reason I wanted John on, we talked about John's book, by the way, The Geek Atlas, which came out a few weeks ago. It was a wonderful, wonderful book. And it's a series of articles about places that are famous in geek history. Did you visit all of those places?
A lot of them, not all of them.
128 of them, fittingly.
Yeah, 128 places. And when I got the idea for the book, I actually just went on Amazon because I wanted to buy that book. I thought it must already exist. And then when I found out it didn't, I wrote down a list of about 70 places where I'd already been. And then I started researching the additional number to make it up to 128.
Wow, that's cool. And like any good open source programmer, you scratched your own itch. You wrote the book.
Yes, basically, it's like, well, somebody's got to write it, so I guess I will.
Among the places you visit, of course, Bletchley Park.
Yes, absolutely.
This is where this was the top secret installation that the British government set up to crack Enigma. I'm sure it had other roles as well. It's where Ultra was, right?
Well, I mean, the thing about Bletchley Park is it was a location owned by the British Secret Service just before the Second World War, and it became the place that was used to break basically as many as possible of the Nazi German and Italian and Japanese codes during the Second World War.
Going there, was that where you learned about Alan Turing?
Actually, funnily enough, I learned about Alan Turing when I was very young. My parents sent me to a thing at Cambridge University when I was quite a young kid. It was for bright kids to go and have fun in the summer. And I went up to a man there who was probably a professor at Cambridge University and said, so how does a computer work? So this is, we're talking in the 70s. And this man said, well, there's this thing called a Turing machine. And he drew on a piece of paper a Turing machine. And he just basically told me the fundamental underpinnings of computer science as a young kid. And I was fascinated by this idea of this tape that goes back and forth. If anyone's read about Turing machines, it's mechanical. Right. So I'd known about Turing forever. And then, of course, I studied computer science and I studied cryptography. So Alan Turing was a man who I'd known quite a lot about for a while.
1999, Time magazine named him one of the most important people of the 20th century because of his role creating the modern computer. Although he never was able to build one, I don't think.
Well, actually, after the Second World War, he worked at what's called the National Physical Laboratory in Britain on something called the ACE, which was a computer, as we would now recognize it. Ironically, one of the problems was during the Second World War, he had worked on some part of a thing called Colossus. He wasn't the main person on it, but he was well aware of Colossus. And that was a valve-based special-purpose computer built at Bletchley Park.
Our ignorant American audience, valves are vacuum tubes.
Yeah, sorry, vacuum tubes for the American audience. And yes, funny, let's do the translation.
A valve is a very different thing in America.
A valve is actually a valve.
It's actually a valve. Well, it's also actually a valve in the UK.
You have both? Okay, all right.
Yeah, so you had total confusion. But anyway, Turing, so then said, well, you know, we could actually make a computer using vacuum tubes valves and designed it. And he was almost poo-pooed because people said, no, that'll never work. But of course, during the Second World War, he'd seen something related work, but he couldn't tell anybody because it was a big secret. So he was sort of stuck with this. And then, I'm pretty sure it would work, you know.
Yeah, you should try it, guys.
Try it out.
It might work.
So, you know, obviously, other computers did get built using vacuum tubes, and it did turn out they worked.
Now, the great tragedy, I mean, Turing, of course, helped crack the Enigma code. He was a national hero, really. But the great tragedy, he was gay, which was, of course, illegal and considered to be a mental illness in his lifetime.
And we also know there's so few British gay men.
It was so rare that the government went after him. In fact, this is really sad. They prosecuted him in 1952 and gave him a choice. What was that choice?
Right. They gave him a choice. He could either go to prison, which was the normal punishment for essentially being caught being gay. And of course, that's what happened to Oscar Wilde under exactly the same law. He got 2 years of hard labor. And Turing was given the choice of either that or he could try a sort of experimental cure thing for homosexuality, which was to be injected with female hormones, which would, the idea was it would kill his libido, which of course it did, and would sort of stop him being gay by curing him. Unfortunately, he did agree to it, and then he grew breasts because of it, and had a major effect on him, you know, mentally and physically.
He killed himself just a couple of years later.
Right, and then 2 years later, he killed himself by eating an apple that had been dipped in cyanide.
So really kind of a unfortunate chapter in British history. But, John, I like it because you decided to do something about it. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, this is one of these stories that's always upset me because it's like, basically, if you look at the timing, Second World War ended in 1945. 7 years later, Turing was arrested. And, you know, 9 years after the end of the Second World War, he was dead.
Yeah.
And then, only 12 years after he was dead, what he had done was no longer illegal, i.e. being gay was no longer illegal in 1967. And so, it's just this awful thing where you got this man who's, you know, an absolute genius, and then he basically, we essentially make him kill himself. And it's always annoyed me. And then for some reason this year on Turing's birthday, which is June the 23rd, I just got really, really mad about it. And I put this blog posting up on my blog and said, you know what? British government ought to apologize to Alan Turing about this. Something ought to happen officially. And the next day after some comments came in, I thought, you know, actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to start a petition to the British government. It's quite a long tradition in Britain of directly petitioning the Prime Minister. People go and gather all these signatures and they deposit this big pile of paper on the doorstep of number 10 Downing Street where the Prime Minister lives. And there's actually a Web 2.0 version of that, which is e-petitions run by the government. And so that night on the 24th of June, I then signed up for a petition to say we ought to apologize for this treatment of Alan Turing. And about a month later, a little bit over a month later, on August the 4th, that petition became public so people could sign it. And what happened over the next 37 days was through my effort and through a lot of people tweeting and all sorts of other things happening, 31,000 people signed that petition. And Thursday night on September the 10th, I got a call on my mobile phone from the Prime Minister.
Wow. Gordon Brown called you? He just called you?
Well, he didn't call me directly. What happened was I had the flu and I had been at home and I hadn't been looking at my email. And I, on the Thursday night, I thought, I've got to look at my email because of a work thing tomorrow. I had to tell someone to do something. So I log into my email and there's this email that says, please urgently call number 10 Downing Street, re your petition.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I looked at the number and I called and I was put straight through to somebody in number 10 Downing Street who said, well, we're actually going to make this apology. It's going to happen. We think it's a great thing. And in about an hour, it's going to be made public. And, you know, they read the apology to me to give me an idea of what they were going to say. And I was completely blown away because if you read the apology, there's no nuance to it at all, which of course is always a worry with anything that's political. And then this woman says to me, Gordon would like a word with you.
Wow.
And so I was at that point, my heart started beating. And about 10 minutes later, my mobile phone rang. And she says to me again, well, I've got Gordon for you, and hands him the phone.
What did he say?
So that was, well, he, sort of things you might expect. He thanked me for bringing up this petition, you know, getting so many people to sign it. He said he thought it was very public spirited of me to go off and do this. He talked for a while about how he hadn't really realized the story of Alan Turing, you know, hadn't really seen, you know, what happened at the end of his life. And he thought it was a wonderful opportunity to talk about that. And he also links it, of course, with all the other people who were prosecuted under these laws. So if you look in the apology, he talks about the probably about 100,000 other people who had been prosecuted over the years. Yeah. So he just, you know, just an amazing thing that he suddenly came out with this apology. I was in it for the long haul. I thought, you know, I've got 31,000. I was trying to get to the number one spot on the website because I was number five, fifth most popular petition. So it all happened rather quickly. It was a rather amazing month, actually, because there was a lot of things going on behind the scenes to get that number up there.
It's John, really. Did you start the petition with the hopes that it would actually get through, or was that just, you know, something to do because you thought it was the right thing to do without any hopes that it would actually happen?
I really hoped it would happen. because I really thought it was just an awful story. And every time I think about Alan Turing, I'd suddenly get angry about it again and think, this is terrible. It shouldn't have happened. But if you read my blog, I said quite clearly, gosh, I don't think I'll get 500 people to sign this. You know, he's known, of course, to computer people, Alan Turing, but he wasn't well known, in my opinion, by the general public. So I was pretty blown away. Actually, I was pretty blown away once I got to 5,000 signatures. And then on August the 31st, the BBC wrote a story about it. And that really blew it up, because that night I had gone to bed feeling pretty happy about 5,000 signatures. And at some time later on in the day, I punched up on my iPhone the petition website, and there were 16,000 signatures. And if you look on the story I wrote for O'Reilly about it, there's this incredible graph where you can see the effect of certain news organizations. And there's this almost vertical jump in the number of signatures when the BBC spoke about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, yeah, touched a nerve. Yeah. It obviously touched a nerve.
Bam. It just goes up.
That's the power of the Beeb. Yeah. I have to say, yes, Gordon Brown, who's not notorious for his eloquence, is really quite eloquent in this apology. He says, yes, Alan and the many thousands of other gay men who were convicted as he was convicted under homophobic laws were treated terribly. Over the years, millions more lived in fear of conviction. I'm proud that these days are gone. And that in the last 12 years, this government has done so much to make life fairer and more equal for our LGBT community. This recognition of Alan's status as one of Britain's most famous victims of homophobia is another step towards equality and long overdue. Have they ever apologized to Oscar Wilde?
No.
Maybe we should start another petition.
Yeah, do another one. Do number two.
He says,
I'm not going to do another one. It was a lot of work.
Yeah, you know? I bet. On behalf of the British government.
I think of a lot of things we should start petitions for. I want that system in France.
Yeah, it's a great, it's kind of, well, it's a
here's
wonderful
the really
thing.
Cool thing.
Yeah.
The really cool thing is that all the code for that petitions website is open source. And you can just go download it.
So we could set up our own petitions website or in the US here. We just take the code. Then look at that.
Yeah, if you look under the fact,
I think I need an apology from David Pogue.
Okay, we can start. Let's start. Can we have the Prime Minister give you that apology? It's really an eloquent apology. It's actually quite moving. At the end, he says, on behalf of the British government and those who live freely, thanks to Alan's work, I'm very proud to say we're sorry. You deserve so much better.
It's pretty amazing. Even when he was himself on the phone with me, he was really quite clearly moved by the story and happy to be talking about it. So,
well, John, thank you for doing that. I think it's wonderful that you did that. It brought a lot of attention to a guy who was very important to our industry and to a grave injustice that was done to him. So I think in a number of ways, you've done a really great thing.
Well, let's get him some publicity for this book. Tell us about some of these places that you visited.
It's so cool. I have a copy here. You got to look at this book.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at what I have online, but
so
you have
cool.
a copy.
Yeah, let me get a copy. Go ahead, John.
But what's some of the places? Because, I mean, it'd be kind of a challenge for people to, like, come up with places that you left out, because you actually have a lot of places in here that I didn't even think about.
Let me grab the book. The book is right behind me up here. Since you're looking for it. Hold up the camera. This is the Geek Atlas.
I'm guessing a couple that you might have left out. I can try as a game.
Go on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, how about Area 51? Do you have that one in there?
Yeah, it's in there.
Oh.
No, because it's not. Because
it's not
nothing to read.
Area 51 was not. Okay, good. I got one.
I thought it was. Oh, all right.
How about Cape Canaveral?
No. Yeah, of course, Cape Canaveral.
Okay. Wait. Alamogordo, New Mexico.
That's a good one. The testing ranch. Is that where the sound of...
Well, they sent some rockets up and then they...
Alamogordo, yeah.
The Wernher von Braun kind of place.
Right.
No,
so White Sands Missile Range.
White
is
Sands
in there.
Is in there.
White Sands is good.
That's pretty good.
What about Vandenberg?
No, I didn't have Vandenberg. There's one of the problems with the U.S. sites is a lot of military and NASA sites, and so you get lots of overlap. So in the end, I had to cut a few. So if you look at the NASA ones, there's the Glenn Research Center, because they do lots of interesting basic science stuff there. And, of course, there's Kennedy Space Center. But, you know, lots of people have written to me and said, well, what about Houston? What about, you know?
That's what you're going to get, obviously. But those are places that I think would be cool to visit.
The Skunk Works at
Lockheed, you know, you can't get in.
Funny that, actually, I wrote to them and asked them if there were ever any public visits. And they did have the good humor to actually reply to me. And probably put me on the no-fly list as well, just for us.
I'd like to visit your super-secret facility. I'm writing a book.
Skunk Works.
Yeah, no, I think I brought the book home, but John, it's a beautiful book. It's glossy. It really is like a regular, you know, like a travel guide, but with lots of pictures. It really is. You did a nice job. I love it.
Well, people should go buy it then. What's it sell for? Where can you get one?
Everywhere.
Where can you get it? Well, how much does it cost? I actually don't know. I'll have to look at the back. It says it's $29.99.
Is it O'Reilly? But
it's O'Reilly, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's everywhere. Yeah. Oh.
He says, so it's everywhere.
John says, oh, O'Reilly, oh.
I was thinking it'd be Random House or something.
It's beautiful. You know what? They did a gorgeous job. There's no animals on the front or anything. It's a really nice.
No, there's no animals running it. I'll show you the cover one more time. And then
it's beautiful. Look at it. See lots of pictures.
Oh, yeah.
It's got Darwin and Marie Curie and various other people on the front cover. So,
what was give us one of your favorite places, and then we'll move on to the news of the week.
The one that's most unusual, I think, in the US is probably Experimental Breeder Reactor 1, which is in Arco, Idaho. Mm. And the best thing about that is a breeder reactor, obviously, but in the parking lot outside, there are two nuclear aircraft engines. The U.S. had this idea they were going to use nuclear reactors.
Oh, yeah, I remember that vaguely.
Terrible idea.
Yeah, I remember vaguely that concept.
That's such an awful idea.
They were even talking about making cars with...
You know, if the oil crisis continues, it may happen.
A little car with a...
As long as the plane didn't crash or, you'd get the crew back alive or anything like that, then it was pretty much fine, So, but the engines are worth going and looking at because they are simply the sort of completely crazy contraption. Here's a nuclear reactor. Here's half a jet engine. And it sort of seems like the size of a small house. And you've got to say to yourself, how big was the aircraft that was going to go in? Well, the answer is pretty freaking big. The runway was going to have to be miles long.
It's like a dreamliner. We're going to talk tech news in just a bit. The book again. We'll just give you another plug. And I know it's really late in the UK. So if you start to pass out, you can go to bed, and we'll just.
I'll get a pillow.
You get a pillow for yourself. But we are going to cover the tech news, all of it, in just a little bit. Before we do that, I do want to mention our friends at GoToMeeting. Got to send you to gotomeeting.com/twit so you can get that great deal on the best meeting software in the world. Our friends at Citrix are big sponsors of the show. We thank them so much for all the support. And one way you could support us is by taking a look at GoToMeeting. Now, we've arranged a 30-day free trial so you can see if it'll help you with what you... Let me give you an idea of what GoToMeeting is. It's a very affordable way to meet with clients and colleagues. I think we all have decided that travel is kind of not in the picture these days. It's awfully expensive. American Express says the average cost of a business trip is, what would you guess? $1,000.
That's low.
I would have thought more.
Yeah.
Maybe because they include business trips across town and stuff, but pretty serious costs. $49 a month, as many meetings as you want. And these are, I have to say, effective. We use them on the shows. We use them all the time in meeting with other people because it is a very engaging, effective way to meet. Conference calls are a snooze, but this way you're seeing something. It's visual. You can collaborate. I can give you control of my computer, so it's great for training. You can actually, while we're having a GoToMeeting, give me control of your computer as a meetee. It's completely flexible that way. Very easy to install. If you go to gotomeeting.com/twit right now, you'll have it installed in just a couple of minutes. Set up that account, but make sure you use that site so we get credit for that. And you can try it free for 30 days. I think you're going to find a lot of uses for it. Highly recommended. Tell the boss and your colleagues and your clients, gotomeeting.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. Once again with us, John C. Dvorak from Channel Dvorak, also here. For the first time, I'm very glad to have him, Patrick Beja from the Phileas Club and other podcasts in France. Where are you in Paris, Patrick?
Yes, absolutely. I think France is pretty much Paris. There's no other city.
A
Parisian would say that. I know it's not true because my daughter was in Rennes for a year last year.
First time I went to France, it was years ago, and I didn't know it. I was down in Bordeaux, and the... people kept running me off the road and giving me the finger, and I kept saying, "What? They hate Americans?" And the guy says, "No, you're driving around a car with Paris plates."
They thought you were Parisian. Really? Is that true?
I'm telling you, it's a fact.
That's very interesting.
It does happen sometimes.
Hey, by the way, can you move a camera and show that dog? You actually have a giant bookshelf in here.
Yeah.
And in the bookshelf, within the bookshelf itself, There's the dog sleeps.
Isn't that nice? It's a little cozy little den for him. The dog sleeps within the book. That's our spy code. If you meet John at an airport, you say, "The dog sleeps." And he goes, "Within the bookshelf." And then you'll know.
Right, then we know.
Then you know. Stories, ladies and gentlemen. There's some really, really big stories this week. The Department of Justice filed its brief in the ongoing Google book search settlement issue in about a month. A judge is going to decide whether to let this settlement go through. The Department of Justice said some interesting things. One thing it said that I thought was, I was glad to hear him say, is that allowing Google to scan in the works of the world, even ones currently in copyright, is of benefit. However, they said, we don't want you to reinvent copyright law with this settlement, and we think that that's possibly what it's going to do. We want you to make sure you consider visually impaired people. The full access is important. And we also think that the data has to be open in a variety of ways. I mean, a lot of criticism on this data because Google has asserted, you know, the rights to sell it, to own it. They say, we'll scan it, but we'll get to keep it. Also, Google has been criticized for privacy, potential privacy issues. Everybody would know what you're reading. And Google, we trust Google with a lot of information about us. So I'm not sure that's a...
Has anybody actually run this thing down in any meaningful way that it makes sense? Because every time I read these stories, it's like, it's all a lot of vagaries. I mean, people are moaning and groaning about what Google's up to, but...
Well, I'll give you an example. There's a guy named Jeffrey Nunberg. I love him. He's a regular contributor on NPR's Fresh Air. He's a linguist. I think he's at Stanford. Maybe he's at Cal. He's in the Bay Area. And he said, you got to look at the metadata that Google's recording on this stuff. It's worthless. He says, this stuff is worthless for research. Google's attributing the year 1899 to half the books, just kind of randomly. He's got a long list of metadata issues. So that's one. The privacy complaint, you know, you're always going to hear about that whenever Google's involved. What are they doing? What are they keeping our information? I think that's a red herring. I do think that the biggest issue is that Google seems to want to control these orphan works. Once they've scanned them, they have the right, because they've paid to this, you know, this fund, to resell them, to use them in various ways. And I think that that's something that's concerning to a lot of people. So I think there are some legitimate concerns about it.
No, I think there are too, but I've never seen a really good breakdown. You know what I mean? It's like it's always.
I think you should read the DOJ's brief. Actually, I thought it was surprisingly good, and not particularly legalistic. Danny Sullivan has a good kind of breakdown and analysis of it, and a link on his search engine land to the full PDF.
Okay, well, I'll make sure to read that before the next show.
It says the United States is committed to working with the parties constructively, and I think that the DOJ is saying we want to support this going forward, but we just think that. They say the inaccessibility of many works due to the lack of clarity about copyright ownership and copyright status is a matter of public, not merely private, concern.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a huge deal.
Yeah.
It is a big deal, but the real problem is everyone is having problems with Google doing this, but really Google shouldn't be doing this. I mean, they're only doing it because no one else came in and did it before.
I agree.
They've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and where is... It maybe even the government should have done it, or.
But I think it's clear now that nobody's going to do it. Google has been doing this for 5 years. They have a huge head start. They've done millions of volumes.
You know,
Microsoft started it last year and abandoned their book.
They started in 2006. Google, I believe, started in 2004. Microsoft 2 years later, and then they abandoned
it. And then they said,
the thing. I agree with this, that why is Google having to do this? Because I remember in the 1980s when computers were really getting ahead of steam and people were talking about these issues, and the big concept was everything's going to be digitized, all the books in the world will be digitized, the entire Library of Congress is going to be digitized, and we're going to have information at our fingertips kind of thing. You know, before the internet came along, that was the buzzword. And meanwhile, so Google, nobody does it, like you said, and then Google starts doing it and everybody starts complaining about it.
Eric Schmidt said, I'm open to a better solution. You'll recall we had our solution and we were sued over it. And then we had a God knows how many years of negotiations with 27 parties, and we've actually produced a deal. This is quoted by Danny Sullivan again in Search Engine Land. We didn't think we should be sued in the first place. In fact, a lot of people said that what Google was doing is fair use. They weren't, you know, well, they weren't scanning to publish. They were scanning to index, and then they would put, you know, an excerpt on if you searched for the.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what they do with the websites, right?
Yeah.
Is it so different?
Well, the difference, well, that's the problem. I mean, this is what makes it weird. The websites are just, a website is, you presuppose that when a website exists, it's there to be scanned, it's there to be accessed, it's there to be linked to. There's a bunch of givens with websites. But books that are published, or newsletters, or newspapers, or magazines, are meant to be distributed only by the print medium. There was never any assumption that they were going to be scanned and then show up on the internet. So I'm not absolutely sure that argument's valid.
EFF worried about privacy, of course.
Of course.
Well, I mean, hey, good, somebody's watching this. So, Patrick, what is the attitude? You know, a lot of the critique of this has come from the EU because I think there's just kind of, I get the sense that there's this kind of an anti-American corporate sentiment in the EU in general. Microsoft's not much beloved, nor is Google. What is the sense in France? What do you hear from people about this? Oh, we lost Patrick. Patrick, you're muted. Hello, Patrick.
Yeah.
There I'm sorry.
That's okay. Hello? Go ahead.
You're good now.
Am I back? Okay. Yep. Sorry. Yeah, I feel like, you know, there's really, we're really behind in that field. We don't have any, we're not worrying about digitizing books yet. It's really not something that we care about. So, We really don't have an opinion about.
Don't you think this is, as John said, a huge? I mean, this is what we always wanted: is everything that is known available for search and scan and find online.
Yeah, I personally think it's very important, and definitely it should be done. It's too late, or well, not too late, but it's definitely time. And the real fault is on the industry, which hasn't modernized enough. It's this, you know, the same way Apple came in with iTunes to force people from the music industry to get with the times. And that's definitely something that should be done. And we want to have everything at our fingertips. But in that, in Google's, with the orphan works issue, the problem is that they are appropriating these works for themselves, isn't it? Can someone else then go and digitize these books and use them also?
Oh, or yeah,
that
sure.
would be the main concern.
You can. You have to do the whole process. If Google grabs one of these books, and Microsoft grabbed a lot of books. In fact, a lot of them are, you know, you can turn into books because they released everything to the public domain. But essentially what Google's doing is that they actually own a copyright in some sense to the scan itself. They don't own the books. Let's say it's even a public domain book from 1910. They scan it in, and they now own the scan. They don't own the book. They don't own the words. They own the scan. And what you'd have to do if you wanted to, say you wanted to republish the book for some reason or make it a part of a collection, you'd have to either scan it yourself or find some way to extract the scan from the Google scan. But in fact, you know, there may even be codes in there to catch people doing that. I don't think they'd go that far, but I can imagine it being possible.
So,
both Germany and France have filed briefs to the judge, to this court, against it, saying it would essentially create a monopoly for Google. That's what their concern is. Now, there is, I found,
a monopoly only in the sense that they'll have more books than anybody
because
else.
They've done it. That's
but, right. But you could still sit down tomorrow and scan in 500 books, and you got your little collection. Yeah. You could distribute.
There was
I
launched.
I had an interesting problem with this when I was writing my book, which is that I wanted to include a diagram drawn by Charles Darwin in one of his notebooks, the famous diagram of the Tree of Life.
Yes.
And that is definitely out of copyright. Darwin's dead.
My mother made a hooked rug of that, as a matter of fact.
So that,
as a gift from my paleontologist
actually,
father.
Yeah,
I have it.
Well,
yeah,
you have it. I think that explains it all.
So that diagram is actually in Cambridge University. They have the original. To get a high-quality scan of that, you have to pay a license fee to Cambridge sure. University, because what they're licensing is the scan. So the claim is that the scanning is a new work.
Right.
And they can then apply copyright law to that.
I agree, and that is actually absolutely true.
That's reasonable.
And that's why a lot of museums around the world won't let you take photos of the artwork in there, because they're selling slides usually of the same artwork in the front lobby store. But the fact of the matter is a Monet, for example, typically is in public domain. And if you wanted to copy it, make another painting that, you know,
but how would you? Because they won't let you take a picture.
Well, the thing is, the great museums are not, that's not their business to.
Right.
And so you go to the museum, the Met in New York, and you can take all the pictures you want.
Oh, really?
But you can't. Yeah. And in fact, most great museums let you take photos, but you can't.
Yeah, I took pictures in the Louvre. That's right.
Yeah.
But
you can't take usually pictures of the special collections that are on loan. Because the people who loan those paintings,
they want the rights.
There is a
European answer to Google book search. It's called Europeana.
No.
When it went online, it went down 10 million hits in the first week. You think, Patrick, this is not the answer.
No, sure. I mean, there are efforts, but there are other efforts in the U.S. also. Google is the only one who is doing this really seriously and really systematically. And they are the only ones who can bring the costs down enough that it's feasible on a large scale. So I think, I don't know. I just don't get what the big deal is. If they want to go and do it and license it properly and then want to use it, why do the people who complain not go and do it instead of complaining?
Yeah,
that's my gripe.
There is, I think the libraries have, and the states also have an initiative, which is way, way, way behind. Why not let Google do it? I think this is what's going to happen. I think this is appropriate. It's appropriate for the judge to look at this. It's appropriate for these parties to weigh in. Google has not said we won't negotiate. They have not been intransigent. They've been trying to solve this. It's appropriate to assert all of these interests and let work it out with Google if we can,
you know,
and let them go ahead. I mean, I don't think they should have free reign.
Like the writer, one of the writers' unions, not the Writers Guild in L.A., but I think it's called the Writers Union or something. This is some group out of I can't remember which group it is, but they were moaning and groaning about this to an extreme, saying that, you know, Google's, you know, stealing their copyrights. But, you know, again, one of the things that we're missing out on here is that most of the books, despite the fact they have a lot of new books that have scanned in, are these weird books that are out of print. They're out of
copy. They're orphaned.
And they're being thrown away. I might want to mention this, by the way. The University of California, which has one of the largest libraries in the world, I think only second to the third, to the Library of Congress and the New York Public Library. Those are huge. But the UC Berkeley has the other one, the big monster. You can go over there to a couple of the rooms there, and they are selling off lots of the books because so many books are still being printed that the collection is out of control. And there's books that are just basically being lost to time. I mean, they're not going to, there will be no copies of these books available for anyone who wants to do some back research. And who knows what valuable products or books are being discarded. I see nothing wrong with any of this personally. I think you
don't worry about
scan everything in.
You don't worry about it creating some sort of rights for Google or limitations on what you can do or.
You know, you can always nationalize them, you know, just go in and.
You're a socialist.
Bring in the cops and bust up the place.
Without going the French route, at least let them just get it in digitized form, and then we'll worry about what we're going to do with it. At least get it on the computer.
Yeah, don't stop them, in other words. Let them keep doing this. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually disappointed that Microsoft crapped out in this deal because they worked, I think they did about 2 years worth of scans, and they did, I think, 700,000 books or something along those lines. And they copied most of the University of California, and because I keep working on these perpetual projects that I never finish. And I was using that Microsoft search because their search was actually superior to the Google one for going plowing through books. And I was searching, finding all kinds of interesting things, especially in these economics books that were written around in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Then I could search them this way. And I was thinking to myself, at least for this 2 year period, God, I should go back to grad school because I could do research on a thesis or any sort of paper so quickly with really good data and find stuff really fast. It just was marvelous. But then, boom, they decided to just drop it. The Google's,
yeah, you know, I guess,
Google's
I guess
harder.
That's the point. I don't want people to think that I'm a Google fanboy or that I want to defend them. I don't want just Google to do this. I want Microsoft to do this. I want Amazon to do this also, and I want every government in the world to digitize all their books in their national libraries.
Right, and actually all the publishers, in fact, the publishers were working with John Warnock's son for a while with some company he had. I can't remember the name of it. You might.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that he was familiar. They were sending him all the digital files that, because books today, there's not really a book being published today that doesn't have a digital format somewhere right, along right. the line in the publishing process. And so they were giving him stuff, but then he would resell it in a digital format in some way that would make them money. And I don't know what happened to that initiative, but the fact is that everything should be digital and should be backed up all kinds of different ways and kept here and there and then be searchable. So somebody, for example, in Lawrence, Kansas, can walk into their little library that's run by one of these modern librarians, and there's many of them, who know more about, you know, how to search and find things than anybody else, and go up to a terminal and be able to get all the world's great works and be able to do some research in Lawrence rather than having to be in, you know, some big, you know, university somewhere.
I agree. And also, if these books then become printable with these espresso book machines, then I think that'd be fantastic, because there are so many books that aren't available that you might want to get one copy of in some random place.
Ironically, that's one of the plaintiffs in this that put together the Gary Reback Alliance. He's, of course, the attorney that went after Microsoft in 1998.
Well, yeah,
he's representing Microsoft actually, he defended Microsoft. I shouldn't say went after Microsoft. The DOJ went after Microsoft. He's representing Microsoft. I think the EFF is in on this, Amazon. But it's also the Internet Archive, which is one of the groups, Brewster Kahle's group. Brewster Kahle's the one who was going around with the bookmobile and the instant print thing, trying to get books in people's hands.
Yeah, and Brewster's the one who picked up all the Microsoft people gave their
he's
huge
got
collection
their
to
their database. Yeah.
Right.
So I'm not sure why.
But the search engine's missing. This database is there, but there's no more search engine.
Yeah. I don't understand, frankly, why they would fight it. But we'll give them a chance to respond. Hey, here's an interesting story that really won't affect you, Patrick, or you, John Graham Cumming, because it's a U.S. issue.
And the U.S. doesn't affect the rest of the world.
Well,
at all,
so. wait till you hear what I'm about to say, and you'll understand. You know, we're debating here in the U.S. about health care, nationalized health care. And Roger Ebert, who, as you know, had a cancer surgery, lost his voice, went to Medicare, asked for a device that would help him talk. Medicare's response, he said, they offered me an $8,000 custom device with a tiny little computing power, small dim screen. He says, I tried the built-in speech software on my MacBook, found it much more practical. It'll read anything aloud, including what I had to find on a web page or an email message. Several voices are built in. Others are downloadable. I combine talking and web surfing. He said, for instance, sharing a news headline with my wife. Insurance companies will not, the Medicare will not allow him to spend the money on a MacBook because, get ready for this, it can be used for something else. Government.
So wait a minute, let me get this story straight.
It can be used for something besides speech synthesis.
So instead of like the $2,000 for a reasonably decent MacBook, that's no good.
$8,000.
But $8,000 is okay.
Yeah.
Okay, makes sense.
Many users with disabilities, this is from an article on Apple Insider, are barred from choosing cheap off-the-shelf technologies by Medicare or private insurance companies who insist on only covering far more expensive devices that don't work as well. For instance, in the New York Times article about a woman named Kara Lynn, who had lost her voice to ALS, Medicare paid for an $8,000 Windows PC running speech synthesis software, but government rules require the PC be disabled from doing anything other than speech in the fear that Lynn might benefit from features unrelated to her disability. The vendor will... After the insurer pays, the vendor will, if you give him $50, will reactivate the computer. But the government will not.
Ridiculous.
The government. Now, does that happen?
This is kind of dumb crap that's got this debate out of control.
No kidding.
It's a cheap shot. I'm sure there's a perfectly good reason.
Oh, yeah. There's a Frenchman talking.
There is a reason why the government would do that. No, instead of buying this $8,000 computer, she bought herself an iPhone for $300 running a $150 text-to-speech application. She says it works better, it's portable, and I don't care if it's not insured. I don't want the $8,000 broken computer.
All right. You can always frame the, they have to have rules and special, you know, sets where they can accept some things and not some others. And you take one example where it doesn't make sense at all. And then all you right, make a generalization. Right.
You're going to be reasonable and all that. Yeah, I don't know.
No and I'm not a fan of the U.S. healthcare system. Believe me. I mean, you spend more money to get crappier healthcare than basically any other country in the world.
I've never asked John, who's our resident conservative, where do you stand on the healthcare debate?
I think that we need a single payer system.
I'm with you. That's very liberal of you.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm surprised.
That you mean like in France?
No, the French system right now is one of the best in the world. And I mean, people always moan about, the British. The British go to France.
Is that true, John Graham Cumming?
Actually, it's interesting you say that because I've lived in the U.S., Britain, and in France, and I've had healthcare in all of them, of course. There you go.
Here's an expert.
At least I've sampled all three. And I actually had my LASIK surgery in France. And I have to say that the French system, for me, was the best. Absolutely no question.
And it's a known fact.
Yeah, no, I think it's widely agreed. France and Germany have the best
healthcare.
Well,
I worked with a group that's involved in the medical system, and they told me that, France may have the best system, but the way the infrastructure is, the French doctors don't make as much money, and they come out of school, they're actually trained a different way. There's the entire French health industry infrastructure is so alien to what we do here, or England, or Canada, for that matter, that there's no real apples and oranges.
Yeah, but what
comparison.
About those death panels, Patrick Bejan? What about those death panels? Do you have them?
We have those, of course. Oh, okay. I mean, there's no way it could work.
We have twice as many in England.
Actually, there was a... I won't get off on too much of a tangent, but there's a very good article.
Yes, we must go.
Well, it's kind of technology, because one of the reasons it's so expensive is because it's so highly technical.
It's true, because they have to do over-testing, too. That's one of the problems.
Over-testing, but, there was a great article in Newsweek where he said nobody can talk about the real truth of it, which is most of this money is spent in end-of-life attempts to keep you alive for a few extra weeks. Nobody wants it, but it's the doctors feel they must do it, and that's really where the expense is.
There's a lot of expense.
But nobody
will
talk about it.
Nobody wants to talk about anything.
No, I don't know.
It's either, the Democrats have their shot at ramming it through, and if they can't do it, well, then there you have it.
They've lost their nerve.
Well, I guess.
Hey, here's a good thing the Democrats did for us. Finally, the FCC...
Wait, let me get my pen.
Write this down, John. Mark this day and date, 4:07 p.m. on Sunday. On Monday, the chairman of the FCC, Julius Genachowski, will urge rules from the FCC requiring internet service providers to protect net neutrality, to treat all traffic on the internet equally. And in fact, it's expected these rules will apply to wireless networks too, which is a really great thing. It's expected that he does have the votes on the commission. 3 out of 5 is what he needs, a simple majority, to make these be the rules. It may be that we will have net neutrality in this country.
That's unbelievable.
How about in France? You don't have anything like that. In fact, in France, now let's contrast. The French.
I knew it wasn't going to
pick on the French
for too long. I had to do this.
But the French National Assembly has passed a draft law that would allow illegal downloaders to be thrown off the net. Probably the hardest line policy in all of the world.
It's absolutely ridiculous. We've been trying to fight it for a few months now, and they've had a really hard time to pass it. So to explain to people what it is, it's a three strikes law where if you're caught, quote unquote, downloading something illegal three times, first time you get a letter from your ISP, second time, same thing, third time, you are barred from using the internet for 2 months to a year. And you are on a list that doesn't let anyone provide you with internet access.
Nobody in the country. It would be illegal for them to give you access.
Isn't that great?
Exactly.
and whose idea is this?
Guilty,
well, it's in defense of the assembly. It's probably American music companies, movie companies, and television companies that have proposed this.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Probably.
And by the way, the way they find that you download illegal material is, the commission that will bring down the hammer once again, receives
anonymous, or maybe not even anonymous, but tips from maybe the music industry. So they will say this IP address has downloaded this and this material. They should be banned.
Is there any due process? I mean, can you defend yourself? Is there?
So that was the reason for the delay, because the Constitutional Council said that you couldn't. Do that kind of condemning. Oh, I'm losing my words here. You couldn't.
Sorry, it happens to me all the time. You couldn't convict.
You couldn't convict someone like this without due process, and that was the initial plan, which of course was ludicrous. And so now what they're doing is that they are liking this offense to something like a speeding ticket. Yeah. So you will have due process, but in an accelerated fashion.
All right. So
it's worth saying it's not just France who's doing this, because Britain, there's this thing called Digital Britain, was this report about how we're going to make everything digital and wonderful. And part of that was also cutting people off who were persistent file sharers. So this has been inspired the British to do something similar.
I think they had something like that in New Zealand too. But the real shame in this is that the people who are writing these laws. I remember one reaction from one of the people who was behind the law, which was, you know, we lived perfectly well before we had the internet. There's no need for it.
Oh, jeez.
And that's
you don't really need it. It's a luxury. So
Minitel.
Minitel.
So you didn't need internet. Before we had the electricity.
We've talked about this before.
There you go. No, I think the argument is the same. You know, you don't need electricity.
No.
Yeah. In fact,
who needs indoor plumbing? Really?
You don't need it.
This is asking
running water. Forget it.
Too much.
Yeah. So now it's basically passed. It needs to be approved by the council again, but it probably will be this time.
So you think it will?
It might be
wrong
because
with these people.
Well, I think there's some pressure being placed on these countries. I mean, it's no accident that it's England, France, and New Zealand by WIPO and by eventually American. Copyright interests.
I think they probably would like to get a couple of precedents out there, especially the WIPO people, bring it over here and see how far it gets.
Well, I don't know if the WIPO treaty calls for something like this, but you know, if you want to be a trade partner, you've got to protect other countries' copyrights, and this is oftentimes seen as what you have to do to be a trade partner.
With the Net Neutrality Act, I'm sorry, the law that's going to be probably
rules.
Voted.
We call them rules.
It'll be a rule.
Okay. Does that mean that the ISPs cannot do deep packet inspection and cannot see what you're, you know, restrict on?
I imagine they can still do it, but they can't act on it. So this is what Comcast was accused of, was running, software from Canada that found out that you were doing BitTorrent and terminated that BitTorrent.
Well, they throttled you.
They throttled you or they terminated it, yeah. And I know in Canada, it's certainly a big problem. Whenever we're on a Skype call with somebody, after about an hour, it starts to deteriorate because the ISPs up there just say, well, you've had enough.
That's enough
VoIP for you.
You're done.
Well, yeah, I guess as important as it is for us in the negative sense, this law that was just passed, it's extremely important. And the net neutrality one is extremely important. And I really want to applaud you guys, because I consider you as part of the American people, for voting it, because it might show us the way. It's an extremely important rule, and it should be voted.
Yes.
Well, there are people that debate that.
Well, most of these people don't think that the government should be involved in this, that they should let the market bear out.
Not even that so much. There's, I don't know, you know, Andrew Orlowski is the biggest.
Oh, God.
He is the biggest complainer about this of anybody. And everyone's, if you actually listen to him, we should get him on the show, even though, to be honest about it, he's hard to understand because he's so British. But he actually makes a logical argument, and it's actually more complicated than that. There's other people I've heard that don't like the idea of this net neutrality thing, because it's not even just the market; it's just the you know, some, I mean, if I'm paying for paying extra money, I mean, it's going to create a situation. So I'm paying for the Comcast double speed, blah, blah, right. blah. And I'm going to pay $100 a month for it. You get half the speed for half the price, or let's say. How's that net neutrality?
This is Orlowski writing in The Guardian. He says, the UK's most prominent internet engineer, Professor John Crowcroft of Cambridge University, thinks that activists had imagined a bogus demon. Net neutrality is a misdirection, a red herring, he says. It's true that we haven't, well, now I gave an example in Canada, but I don't think we have an example in the US, or do we, of discriminating against Google, let's say, or Skype?
No, I mean, this whole thing began largely because, yeah, I think it was the CEO of AT&T who came out shooting his mouth off about stuff he didn't know anything about, and says, I don't see why Google should be getting a free ride.
Orlowski quotes,
as if Google's not paying for their bandwidth.
Orlowski quotes Robert Kahn, one of the fathers of the internet, who says, the internet has never been neutral. Oh, no, this is Crowcroft talking. Without traffic shaping, we won't get the convergence that allows the innovation of TV and online games we've seen in data and telephony. That's the defense that Comcast uses, too, as well. We've got to shape bandwidth. We've got to keep the bandwidth hogs from stopping everybody else from using the internet in a useful way.
Yeah, that's a different issue. You can open a million pipes up and just bloom. You can bring the whole thing down.
Yeah.
I didn't think that was the issue of net neutrality. I mean, sure, you can do tiered speed and pay more to get more speed. That's fine. But the real issue with net neutrality is selecting who you allow to your users to have access to and who you don't allow. That's a much deeper, more troubling thought.
Yeah. I'm with you on that.
Speed, who cares?
No, I agree with that, too.
We'll get Andrew on.
I'm on both sides of this argument because of the Orlowski points are interesting, but the other points are logical. And so what, you know...
Well, he does make a good point when he says, you know, this is a straw man because it hasn't been a problem. So now you're making rules.
Right. I agree with that, too. This hasn't been a problem. I haven't seen anything. I don't get my Skype choked off. It doesn't get cut off.
Right.
Nissan... Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see an ISP try and cut access to Google and then see how the market reacted to that.
Well, this is the problem, at least in the States, and I don't know, I imagine it's the same in the UK and France, is that there isn't really any competition among internet service providers. There's a, you know, a paucity of potential companies you can work with. So
in France there is.
No, that's not true at all. I mean, in the UK and in France, we have much higher bandwidth available, and there's a lot of competition. When I lived in France, I had a 100 megabit connection at home, and it was costing tens of euros a month. There's tremendous competition.
So in France and England, it's not government run. It's run by private parties for the most part.
Absolutely. I'm in the process of switching broadband providers at home because I've got fed up.
And
with
have how many different companies could you choose from?
Oh, I don't know. Tens.
Yeah. See, in most U.S.
You could choose, and you're going to get wait a minute. Let me get this straight. You can choose from like six providers, and you're getting like 100 megabits per second, and you're paying like 10, 20 bucks a month or 30 bucks. Wait a minute. You're saying 10 euros, which is about $50 U.S.
No, 10 euros.
Right. Well, something like that. It's some ridiculous.
So when I lived in France, so I had a choice of 1 megabit, 20 megabits, or 100 megabits. And I think the 100 megabits had 20 megabits up, but my memory's fading.
I'll take that.
And it was not expensive.
I pay $700 a month for 9 megabits up and down. Of course, it's a...
Yeah, but you're in a dedicated
it's quality
fiber,
line.
Yeah.
But
it's not shared.
I pay 30 euros a month for 30 down and 8 up.
See, in the States, we generally have a couple of choices. You're going to have if you're lucky, you have a cable company that's offering internet service. Your phone company might be. There might be a few independent ISPs on that phone company's
or
line.
Maybe a fiber provider that may be.
Maybe.
Well, it depends. If you're out in the suburbs where there's fiber,
Verizon.
You can get it.
But usually, most people have two or three choices and not many more. So that's what keeps it. That's what makes net neutrality an issue, because if you get a couple of people colluding, saying, well, yeah, let's cut back on that YouTube, it's killing us.
Well, either that or if they just collude on the price.
Well, they clearly do that.
Yeah, the prices are too high.
Way too high.
It's two different issues, really. I don't think we should lump them together. Maybe they are effectively lumped together, but pricing is one issue, and selecting which content you throttle is another one. Throttle or cut, because you were talking about Google just now. Google is not going to be the issue.
BitTorrent is going to be the issue.
It's well, it depends what your business is. If you're a cable company, it's BitTorrent. If you're a phone company providing the internet access, it's Skype.
One of the reasons I find this argument kind of, you know, maybe I don't care so much about, because we're having so much non-net neutrality now that's part of the system. For example, and Leo will agree to that when I bring it up. My site, Dvorak Uncensored, dvorak.org/blog, is blocked all over the country.
Yep.
And for no other reason than the word uncensored is in the URL, or not even in the URL, it's just in the header. And it's done by these third parties that are filtering systems that are all over the place. They're in libraries, they're in corporations, they're in universities, mm-hmm. they're in research companies. They're everywhere. And there's about 25 or 30 of these guys, and they block content. And just, where's the laws against this nonsense? I thought if you're on the internet, you should be able to see what's on the internet.
Well, imagine the situation if your last name was Cumming, spelled C-U-M-M-I-N-G.
Do you get blocked, John?
Oh, yeah. I get blocked. And I also famously... Eudora would flash up this.
Oh, you get the hot pepper,
the hot red pepper. Yeah. Using disgusting language and emailing this guy.
In fact, how do you get any emails delivered at all?
Yeah, really. Yeah, my email string.
It's like being named Freddy Viagra. I mean, it's not a good.
It's funny because my whole family at one point had Hotmail accounts, and Hotmail would not allow us to use our actual name.
Oh dear!
And so we all had to fake last names.
Oh dear!
So we all actually had quite offensive fake last names. We just happened to get through the filter.
There's a very large. You may be related, but there's a very well. I guess this is Cummings, which is a very large motor manufacturer in the United States. They make some of the top diesel engines in the world.
You know, there's so many things to think of now when you're naming a child. You really got to pay attention.
Well, of course, yeah. You know, when it's your last name, it's a bit more difficult. But it is a problem. And, it, you know, I do get blocked in some places. And it's actually got to the point now where it just amuses me because it's so stupid. But early on, Google used to serve up pornographic ads if you searched for me.
And,
I actually wrote to Google and asked them to stop it. And to their credit, they did do something that doesn't happen now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen much porn on a Google search.
I don't think
recently.
They do search. They don't do that. Sell those ads anyway.
They've done a good
so
job.
So you write a petition to 10 Downing Street and you get it like a written apology. You write to Google and they stop sending you the spam you don't want. How exactly do you word these things? I want to know.
He's British. I actually, him properly.
You know, what you do is you ask very, very politely. That's what in Britain that works. I actually published some of the emails I sent to people about the petition on the O'Reilly website, and you can, like, particularly for the BBC, because that big hit from the BBC, I actually just wrote to them and said, you need to cover this story, it's important. And they did. So it's always worth a try.
Says
asking nicely.
Freddie Nigerian bank scam wrote and tells us this is all right. We're going to I want to remind people that you can and we did. You know, I said this briefly last week, but I want to emphasize it. You can now call us. We have our own Google voice number and leave a message. And I'd like to start incorporating your thoughts into the show. We don't want to leave you out. So we have an easy to remember number. It's 9513 TWIT. VM. Okay, I lied. It's not that easy to not remember, but that's the number. 9513 TWIT VM. That's 951-389-4886. It's one of those cases where the number is actually easier to remember than the letters. But do call us, leave us a message, and maybe next week we'll be including your message. Try to keep it short. Remember that if you leave us a message, you're giving us permission to use it on the air, and we do reserve the right to edit it. For clarity and length. Isn't that what the New York Times says when you send them?
Is that what they say?
Yeah. We reserve the right to edit for clarity and length. We're going to get back to our great panel, John C. Dvorak of channeldvorak.com, John Graham Cumming of gcg.org.
JGC.
Note the use of initials in the URL. And Patrick Beja of, what is it, French Spin?
Yes, it's really not the easiest name to remember, is it?
Frenchspin.com.
French Spin.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
But right now I want to remember our friends from Squarespace who have been very supportive of the show, and we love Squarespace right back at them. Go ahead, John. You can just sneak right by. He's going to get a little drink of water, take a break. You all can if you want. Squarespace is the place to go to create your website, whether it's a blog, a photo blog, a forum. They have a huge variety of templates, and boy, is it great. Now, I don't want to knock them when they're down, but lately, a number of other blogging platforms have had major security issues. And that's one of the reasons why running a hosted blog at a place like Squarespace is just the right way to do it. You don't have to worry ever about, security. You don't have to worry about sudden bandwidth demand, because Squarespace, boy, they have a very sophisticated technique for keeping the sites up no matter how much traffic you get. Their virtual hosting, you don't have to know about this, but the virtual hosting that they use is very sophisticated. Starts at $8 a month for blogging, building, hosting, designing, and impressing your friends and fans. But try it free right now for 2 weeks by going to squarespace.com/twit. You'll find importers there for all the major blog platforms. Exporters, too, so you're never stuck. There's a Squarespace iPhone app, great statistics, simple redesigns, great templates to start with, but you can use a Squarespace Ajax capabilities to just drag and drop your site, adjust it the way you want. There's form building, there's social media integration for Twitter and YouTube and MySpace and Facebook and FriendFeed and Dig and all of that. Try it free for 2 weeks. Go to squarespace.com/twit, and if you decide to sign up, you'll save 10% when you use the offer code TWIT. Squarespace.com/twit. You want to see a Squarespace blog? Go to our Inside Twit blog. That's where we post all of our Inside Twit postings. They did a great job setting up a wonderful blog for us. In fact, that's a good place to go today, because we're giving away the ultimate gaming machine. Yay! Finally. And you can win, or actually, we have the entries already, so you can't win unless your entry is one of the top 10 we've picked, but we would like you to vote. So go to inside.twit.tv. Read and look at the 10 entries, and then you can vote for your favorite. And we have a couple of weeks. I think we're going to end this October 2nd, something like this. But we want to give everybody a chance to vote, and you can vote by creating an account on our it explains it all there, but you create an account on our Twit Army site, and you can cast your vote there. But Colleen's got the entry up, the entries up, all the different reasons. We asked people, what are your top 10 reasons why you, of all people, should get the ultimate gaming machine that we designed last year. Really beautiful, beautiful box. Colin did a great custom paint job. It's custom cooled. It's at insidetwit.tv. And while you're there, you can really take a look at what you can do with a Squarespace blog. They're doing such a nice job. Squarespace.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. So, John, have a seat. John's back with his beverage. Would you like a glass of wine or anything?
Do you have any? Do you have any Bordeaux in the house? Or
I don't think we. I think we've gone through all the Bordeaux.
Or something decent.
You want a Chinon or Bordeaux?
Well, I don't think you have any Chinon. That would be what the Parisians drink.
That's what Patrick is drinking. are you drinking any wine today, Patrick?
Well, it's 1:30, so not right now.
But, 1:30 should be drinking the Armagnac.
Yeah, that's right. It's time for brandy.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, actually.
Intuit.
I'm going to stick to the water, though. It's my first twit. You know, maybe
yeah,
in a couple.
Yeah, you're probably wise. In fact, I used to drink, and now I realized.
It's really was one a time. Was one a time bad we idea. Had a whole group half sloshed.
Everybody was
good.
Sloshed. You know, it's funny. We haven't done that. I think we did it for a few episodes because we had a wine sponsor, and we haven't done it since, but we still have the reputation as being a bunch of drunks.
Well, you know, the Woodford is still around, isn't it? Or did you guys wipe it out?
I believe it would be there. Is that a wine?
No, that's the bourbon.
Oh, let's see what we have here. Would you like some bourbon?
Well, you know, why not? Oh, yeah, it's right there. Oh, no, this is that stuff, right?
This is the Evan Williams. It's named after the founder of Twitter.
Right, this is the
one. By the way, I just want to say, I did apply to Twitter because you told me where, and somebody put a link up where you fill out the form for the verified thing.
Yeah.
And I guess it shouldn't be much of a surprise, but look what happened. It says, something is technically wrong.
Yeah.
I guess that shouldn't be much of a surprise, but I guess I won't be getting my verification either.
No. Well, you know, the funny thing is I was thinking about it, and say you don't, even Pogue, who is suckered by the phony, that other one.
The phony Dvorak.
The phony Dvorak. I mean, it doesn't say verified on there, but, you know, who's to know that it's still not me? What's good's the verified do? If you don't know about the real guy, about the real site.
They say on here, we can't verify everybody, so, you know, don't expect a miracle.
Yeah, no, but they've verified there are certain supporters.
They verify the celebrities. The Oprahs of the world are verified.
O'Reilly's verified. What does he do that's so special?
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I both are probably more famous than O'Reilly.
Not if you go look at his numbers, he's got over a million.
Well, that's because he's on the suggested user list. Whole Foods and Dell.
What you're kind of telling me here, even though I don't think you're expressing it properly, is that there's a level of corruption.
That's one way to put it, yes. Huh. I don't know if there's bribes being handed out or anything like that.
I want to disassociate myself from this discussion. I love Twitter.
What is your handle on Twitter, Patrick?
Not Patrick.
Really? Not because Patrick?
Was taken. Yeah. Yeah, you know, my Patrick was taken, so I figured I should find something that's somewhat similar. And so I started with Not Patrick. And then a few listeners started naming themselves not their name. So there's a few not someone on Twitter who named themselves.
But that's confusing because you are Patrick.
That's the whole genius of it. Am I really?
Some might call it genius. John Graham Cumming, what is your pornographic Twitter handle?
It's not pornographic. It's J Graham C.
Oh, there you have it.
Would they have let you have Cumming, I wonder?
Probably not.
I have no idea. I mean, I have my real name on there, so they didn't block me from that.
So the chat room, I'm watching the chat room going on with the jokes about the basting the meat. But just because I go.
Whenever John gets up during the show, we.
Yeah, it's an old gag. It goes way back.
They're
asking what that zipper is doing on your shirt, and I'd like to know myself. He has a zipper, like, in the middle of nowhere on his shirt, like in case he had a shoulder operation that needs to be...
You could get in there. I could get arthroscopic surgery in his shirt without taking it off. That's true. It is, you know, it's rather prominent. I didn't really notice that. This is a Scotty Vest polo shirt, a Twit polo shirt. And this, you could put...
Did you get that shirt free, Leo? Did you get that shirt free?
I did, actually, yeah.
You gave that...
I got it for free. I did.
Oh, there you go.
I did.
That
and look, I put my iPod in there. And now it looks like I did have that shoulder surgery. There's a big clunky thing.
You got like some
on
sort
my
of
left
old
breast.
Grandma breast has been flattened and pushed over to the left.
This is the Alan Turing.
You know, Leo,
problem.
I was at the cottage, I think, last year with Nicole and Mark Spagnolo.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave me a cap.
Yes, that has a zipper in it as well. Yes.
It has 30. You have a zipper inside. You have a zipper on the side. It's like
they own a stock in a zipper company.
I think so. No, I love Scotty Vest stuff because that's exactly his idea: is pockets and zippers everywhere. So that's why I have a zipper on my shirt. That's all. It's a very comfortable shirt. Let's see.
News. Hey, there's a thought.
I can get back to the news. The Nissan company is adding Blade Runner sound effects to their electric cars.
Yeah, I don't get what that means.
Well, you know, an electric car is so quiet.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
No. It's like
zzz, it makes a zzz.
Yeah, I don't. I have to listen back, but I think Blade Runner's cars made a kind of a hum.
Is that the issue of the electric cars not making any noise?
They're very
so
quiet.
You can't hear them coming.
That's exactly right. People are getting run over by electric cars because they're expecting.
I was in a parking lot in San Francisco, and one of those little things came by and scared the crap out of me.
Where'd you come from? Exactly.
Hey, here's an idea.
That's just Darwinism at work. You know, eventually we'll kill all the people who don't realize there are electric cars around, and it'll just move on.
Yeah, but I get to Britain, and I look to the right, and the car's coming from the left.
Oh, yeah, that happened. You know, it takes weeks to get over that.
Yeah, you look the wrong way.
Yeah, you look the wrong way, and even though there's big, you know, they have it plastered all over the street in England. Look left. Look left.
No.
But you still, you know, fail to look left.
Yeah, you look right, and you step into the traffic, and there's an electric car, and you're squished.
Well, I mean, in Amsterdam, you're always getting hit by bicyclists, doing the same thing because they're racing around in this. I don't know. It's dangerous.
They say once they get to do 20 kilometers an hour, they're going to turn off the electric sounds because the cars are more noisy anyway. Mm. But at the slower speeds where they can creep up on you. Actually, somebody
has an idea.
Do you think maybe this is an opportunity for iTunes, like ringtones? Now we'll have
car tones.
Damn it, John. That's what I was trying to say. There you go. We think alike.
Car tones.
We Europeans. We've got good ideas.
New. Yeah, car tones.
That's because they can't get any music on their iTunes.
That's a good one.
Like a theremin noise.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of, you know, the earth stood still.
Exactly. 22 states have made texting illegal while you drive.
I didn't know it was ever legal.
It's legal. Well, it's a loophole, I guess. And California's considering it. However,
why would anybody consider it? It should just be illegal.
Many of these states have traffic updates via Twitter. So they're asking that you tweet when you get in a traffic situation.
Well, this makes no sense.
However, it is illegal. Well,
I guess if you're stopped dead on the freeway, that would be a time you could tweet that this, you're stopped dead. That would be okay.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I mean, not if you're running around 60 miles an hour. Road's clear.
State transportation officials insist these are not mixed messages. The tweets are to be read prior to driving. Mm-hmm. Know before you go. Drivers
should be read, but how are they presented?
We don't want people
don't
reading their tweets.
You to send an update that this is all done by GPS and things like that, isn't it?
I think it should be done as a heads up on the right on the windshield. Just have a heads up display.
There you go.
That has all the stuff right there, and you can drive.
My
while
Facebook
reading.
Feed, my YouTube,
just
my
have
Twitter.
It all up there, like the jet pilot has.
You want, you know what you want? You want that new Motorola Click phone that has like as a screensaver, just floats Twitter tweets and stuff past you. Like,
but it should be on the
it should
the
be it should be heads up. I think there is a device, isn't there, that you could put like on your phone that would project it onto the.
That'd be cool.
If it's not been invented, it should be. Well, good news. The Supreme Court upheld an order on Friday to reimburse $300 million in overpayments collected from residential phone customers. That's the good news. The bad news is it was in Canada.
Well, I don't know. That's part of the British Commonwealth. I don't know what you're complaining
about.
Oh,
you're happy. Okay, good. I'm glad. I'm so glad to hear it.
I'll get the Queen onto you.
Would you like to buy Gene Roddenberry's old Mac Plus?
So while you're on the topic of that, Gene Roddenberry gave his Mac Plus, apparently, which is an 01 serial number.
They say it's 01, although apparently it's, well, it's confusing.
Yeah, well, the serial, yeah, it is confusing.
Because they upgraded it.
Now, I don't know. There's a, when's the last time you got to see Woz? Has he come in much up here?
I haven't seen him lately. He doesn't answer
my
emails.
I'd like to get him up here because I want to come up here with my... I have one of the original Macintoshes. Not the Plus, the real one. The first one.
The 128?
Yeah.
Wow.
I have a 128 with no shielding inside, so it still has all those autographs inside. You know about that, right?
Yeah, yeah. They signed the plastic mold.
Yeah, they signed the plastic mold.
All the people on the team, yeah.
Right. I want Woz to...
Oh, that's cool.
...to autograph the outside... Because one of those, I can't believe this, one of these things showed up on the Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah?
You know, there's money to be
made.
Did
they say it was worth something?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, mm-hmm.
He's not saying anything. He wants to keep it a secret.
I'm just telling you.
I'm going to talk to Woz. We'll get him to come. Woz will sign anything, you know.
Yeah, we'll get him up here. I'll get Woz a pen. Sharpie.
We'll supply the Sharpie.
Sharpie. And we can use a box of Sharpies if anyone's listening.
The auction house Profiles in History is auctioning off a Macintosh Plus given by Apple to Gene Roddenberry. They say this is the very first Mac Plus 1 megabyte personal computer to come off the assembly line. It is serial number F4200NUM0001.
Yeah, it sounds like the first one to me.
Well, apparently they're only planning to make 10,000 because after that you run out of numbers.
You got lots of letters.
Oh, maybe they were going to use letters, too. Yeah, it's a megabyte of RAM expandable to 4 megabytes. But then, which is kind of weird, the machine was originally a 128K Mac that was upgraded to a Macintosh Apple Plus by Apple. Uh-huh. But you know what they're saying? So if you look at the back of it, well, they have a picture of the back of it, and it does say, you know, M0001 on it.
Well, it might be legit then.
Yeah. On the other hand, they say they'll only expect to get $800 to $1,200 at it, which would kind of, maybe if Woz had signed it.
Well, it's like if Roddenberry had signed it with a big felt tip pen, it would be worth something.
I got this. Did you get that free, Gene? He got it free.
So I got I have a keyboard from Northgate, and the back of it is signed by Stan Freberg.
Wow. What's the connection? Wow. You just happen to have a keyboard lying around?
No. Freberg was doing some promotion work and advertising for Northgate when they had their that special keyboard that had the asterisk in the right place. They had a bunch. It was like meant for easy.
Why they got Stan Freberg? Must have been ancient.
Yeah. Well, this was years ago. All right. And this Freberg was there. I met him, talked to him, asked him different questions about, you know, radio and what, you know, why he liked it so much. But anyway, he gave away a few of these keyboards that he signed because they were giving these keyboards to people to evaluate. And so
did you get that free?
To evaluate. And so then I grabbed the keyboard and Freberg stopped me. Hey, no, hold on a second. He signed.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah. Now, I'm sure Patrick and John aren't familiar with Stan Freberg. He's a radio pioneer, did a lot of ads. You'd recognize his voice.
Yeah.
He had a very famous voice.
He actually started off as a puppeteer.
Really?
Beanie and Cecil.
Oh, I remember Beanie and Cecil. That's right. Yeah. That was his voice.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was born on August 7th.
Wikipedia. So
and he grew up in Pasadena, actually.
I believe you're right, Patrick, as long as Wikipedia is accurate. Real quickly, I want to get to the one of the bigger stories that we have left out, but we will, which is Skype. Again, more in court, and it's just a mess.
Have you figured out the... The story? I mean, I've been reading
it. This isn't like the Google Book search story. This is one of those crazy stories. Well, here's the issue. It happened again. But I'm going to explain what that means in just a second. It happened. I thought it wouldn't. I thought it couldn't happen again, but it did. It happened again. I thought that only eBay could be that dumb. But it happened again. And you'd think they'd have learned, but no. But before we do that, I do want to mention our friends at Audible.com. You could baste your meat, John, if you... Yo, wait a minute. You're not cooking today. He's not making
dinner.
I'm
having raw oysters. You know, we're back in the months with ours, so I'm going to start checking the oysters out again.
September. Oh, yeah. Because August didn't have an R.
Right.
It's the hot months.
In fact, you can get some confirmation from our French friend. The French believe that the absolute great month for eating oysters is January. And I have to say, I started picking up on that concept.
Because it's the coolest.
I'm telling you, oysters in January are astonishing.
Patrick, I know the French are very proud of their huître, but I think that we have better huître here.
Well, I think if you if you get the ones in Oregon and you go up to British Columbia.
Sorry, I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave this panel.
You got the British Columbia oysters, it just blow your mind.
Even Hog Island out here, just our local oysters, just a very delicious, fresh, crisp flavor. But all right, well, we won't get in a battle over this. You're an oyster lover. Are you?
I'm going to start speaking with a French accent if we do. It's going to be messy.
One thing that is available everywhere that this show is heard, including the UK and France, is the great Audible.com. I want to tell everybody about the Audible deal. Now, this Audible deal is available in the US only, but you can get your Audible books all over the world. And it's just a wonderful place to get online and find something great to listen to. My friend Roz Savage just got back. She's been rowing across the Pacific. She was 3 months at sea. And before she left, I gave her my iPod stocked with 323 Audible books. And she says, I could not. I mean, she's rowing solo for 3 months all by herself. She said, Audible saves my life. She loves these Audible books. Now, if Audible can get her across the ocean, Audible can get you across town, home from work. Great for your commute. Great for the gym. Here's one for John. Ron Paul's book, End the Fed.
Ron Paul. Yeah, thanks.
It's actually, I think this is a speech by Ron Paul. That's one of the neat things about Audible. Well, maybe not.
No, I think he did come up with a book.
He wrote a book, yeah.
I mean, he's been trying. It's a lawyer. I don't want to get into politics on this show, but Ron Paul.
No, Ron Paul, yeah. But that's the point. You can, from left, from right, from the center, from way out in the left field or right field, you can find books about all the topics in the world, science and technology, sci-fi and fantasy. Audible's even recording some of the great sci-fi books that were never recorded. And I have to thank them for that. You can get stuff that was never been on audio before. In fact, go to their Audible Frontiers section. These are the books that they've recorded. They have 2,000. When I first joined Audible, they had a handful. Now they have almost 2,500
It's amazing.
Great sci-fi books.
You should do a book or two.
You know, I want to do a book. They've asked me to do a book, and we're just trying to find one. I'm going to recommend, I mean, there's, oh, man. Our friend Jerry Pournelle, the last time he was on, they did not have this on Audible. They do now. Lucifer's Hammer by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. What a great book. This is a 24 hours worth of listening, and you can get it absolutely free. Actually, you know, I think The Moat in God's Eye, that'd be the one I'd start with. What a classic this is. Go to audible.com/twit2. You get them both. Get the Jerry Pournelle, Larry Niven collection. And absolutely free. You're going to sign up for the Platinum account. That's 2 books a month. And the first 2 books are yours to keep free, even if you decide not to stick around. I know you will, though. This is a great way to listen. On your iPod, on your iPhone, on your Nano, on your Kindle, on your Zune. Works great on the Zune HD. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. As I mentioned earlier, David Pogue will be on in just a few minutes. He's going to, we recorded this earlier, a rebuttal for all the nasty, mean things we said about him last week.
You said you recorded this earlier, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, then I don't get to complain.
You don't get to complain to him, and he will mention that he considers that you were one of the people who was savaging him.
Yeah, because he was on some bogus site.
It wasn't you, it was somebody else's.
I've never even mentioned him on Twitter, ever.
Okay. So I'm gonna send a note.
On here I've talked about him because you brought it up in the conversation. I did say he's a fanboy, but so what?
It's obvious.
Yeah. Now, there's a news story here that I don't know if you covered it last week or not. I want to...
Please, go right ahead.
Did you... Google acquires ReCAPTCHA.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
Why?
I don't know. You know what a CAPTCHA is, of course, folks? Those are those funny letters that they put on... In fact, if you sign up for Gmail... You have to decipher the letters. Apparently, no computer can, but only humans can. It keeps the spammers from signing up for a million Gmail accounts.
It's not the way they do it, of course. You know, what you do is they have these systems available where a spammer will run into, you know, they essentially have, they get to a, the machine gets to a CAPTCHA, and then it sends the web page in mass, like hundreds of them, to people in India or wherever they have them so they can just type into things.
What does this mean?
And then
it means I can type that in.
And they type in the
but they type it in with an accent. So does that work?
Yeah, type it in. Okay. So they type it in, and then they're actually not only in, but they're in, like, you know, permanently. So the CAPTCHAs never come up again. They're like members now, and then the spammers just go crazy.
Right.
So CAPTCHA doesn't work.
They've even
well.
Got a man in the middle, a really clever man in the middle. When you go to a porn site to sign up, you'll get a CAPTCHA, which is just forwarded from Gmail. So they have humans signing up for their sites, and they just use them, and they say, oh, thanks.
Right. The question in my mind is, why does anybody...
Well, it's interesting. Now, ReCAPTCHA was created at Carnegie Mellon with a kind of altruistic bent. It gives you 2 words, right? One word is the actual CAPTCHA, but they don't tell you which of them. The other one is something that was scanned in from a book that they can't figure out what it is. It's part of a book scanning effort. And so Google's going to use this for their Google Book Scan. When they get to a word that their scanner can't interpret, they add it to the CAPTCHA. You don't know which one's a real word, which one's a CAPTCHA word. You type in both because it's a 2-word CAPTCHA. And now they've got a human doing their work for them. Clever, eh? They've learned something from the pornographers.
That's actually genius.
Isn't that genius?
It is genius. But what did they pay for this company?
A lot. Ridiculous amount. Because what's interesting is I thought that ReCAPTCHA was kind of a, I don't know, I got the impression it was like a more of an open source thing. But I guess.
I thought they were going to use it for that idea that I can't remember which blogger had, which was to put ads in the CAPTCHA. But that makes sense, too.
Well, wouldn't that be cool?
That would be good, too. There's a lot of uses here. Now I'm starting to see the light.
Now you realize why Google bought ReCAPTCHA.
Yeah, there's all kinds of possibilities.
Let me see. You know, actually, it's funny. I took that out of the stories because I thought...
Drink Pepsi.
There'll be nothing to say. Wow. Drink
And then you type it and drink Pepsi so it gets embedded in your brain. It's a great... Wow. Pure genius. Drink Pepsi. Okay, I'll
That's
drink Pepsi.
Brilliant. In fact, I'm getting thirsty right now. I want some Pepsi. It doesn't say how much they spent for it.
No, I can't find it either.
I'm looking for a number.
I think it was a private company, so they're probably never going to get it.
They never published a number.
So they're also buying Bright Cove.
Well, that was a rumor. I don't, you know, that rumor, which came from a fairly reliable source, was never confirmed and nothing ever happened. So I don't know if they actually are.
I don't know why they'd want it, but okay.
Well, they bought on too. They've been buying video companies. Bright Cove is kind of what, like Ustream or Stickam for a business. they stream video, or Bitgravity, they stream video for business, right?
B2B. Yeah, they also store and forward stuff. I mean,
okay, so they're a lot like Bitgravity.
MarketWatch used to use Brightcove for its videos that it has on the MarketWatch site.
Right, right.
I don't know if they do anymore.
Why would Google want that? They've got YouTube.
And they've got Google Video, which they were supposed to take down and yet to do so.
Right.
Remember they said they were going to kill it, and they haven't done anything.
They're hoping it makes some money, unlike YouTube.
Maybe they're preparing, they need a steadier infrastructure for the movies that are going to be served through YouTube.
That's an interesting speculation.
Maybe.
That's how you would do the movies. That's very interesting.
Maybe.
Well, they would have to buy it first.
Google's up to something.
Not to be a rumor.
We know they're up to something. Also, Intuit does a very smart thing, buys Mint. Do you use Mint?
I don't use Mint. I don't even know what Mint is.
Oh, I love Mint. I don't think, John or Patrick, I don't think you can use Mint outside the U.S.
No, I tried.
There are competitors in the U.K. that do the same thing.
You've got something we don't have, though. You have Spotify, so.
Well, tell us about Mint.
Mint is something that I resisted because I thought, oh, this is a terrible idea. When they first came out about a year ago, they came out, I think, at TechCrunch 50. I said, oh, this is cool. You give them, a red flag should go up here at a moment. You give them all your bank account logins, all your loan logins,
I don't think so.
All your investment account logins, and they collect all the data from your bank account and kind of balance your checkbook and tell you how much money you've got. They even warn you. I have Mint on my iPhone. They'll send me a warning when a big transaction happens. It'll budget for you. It looks back in history and says, you're spending $50 more on fast food. It keeps saying that to me. I don't know why. Than you have before. So it gives you, and this is nice. This is the iPhone app that gives you kind of like a, and now it wants me to log in. Oh, well. It gives you a summary of what you're worth. You can go online at mint.com. Really, I didn't sign up at first. I thought, oh, this is terrible. I can't use this. I'm not going to give them this information. But then Gina Trapani, who does our This Week in Google show, and I trust as a smart programmer, wrote an article about it saying, well, you know, they use a third party, the same third party that the banks use. In fact, the truth is this third party already knows all your logins because the banks are using them. So it's safe to.
Oh, you know, that reminds me of the, people, if you do mail order or direct marketing, or you can put up a website and people can type in their stuff to a web browser. And then, but some people say, well, I don't want to do that because it goes on the internet and I can't handle that. But if you're in the mail order business or a direct marketing business and you actually set up shop with one of these guys who take phone orders, because I'd rather do the phone order, they require that you have that same exact internet account.
Right.
So they bring up the information on the web browser and type it in instead of you typing it in. So the whole thing's
And they're probably using prisoners anyway.
It's right, which is probably worse.
They're probably using... Exactly.
So the whole thing you can't get around. Well, that's an interesting thing to point to
make. It's a great service. I have to say, I love this service because it does do a really good job of analyzing. And you know, it's a smart service because it's free, totally free. The way it works is they monetize it by selling ads, but they're smart ads because there'll be ads saying, well, I see you're using Fidelity as your broker. You know, you could save $53 a week based on the number of transactions you've had. By going to E-Trade.
Yeah.
It's very smart. Or we can get you a better credit card deal. So that's how they monetize. The interesting thing is they've been eating Intuit's lunch. I mean, Intuit, because of Mint, had to make Quicken Online free. And people still are...
Oh, so it was a smart move by Intuit.
Smart move. They bought the competition out. $170 million, big exit. And there was a lot of criticism by people who said, criticism of Mint for selling out for $170 million, because that's not the new web way to look for an exit to a big company. You should be more like Facebook. You should be building value. You should be turning away the suitors.
Yeah. Right.
If anybody comes to me with $170 million, I'll do
you're
it for 10.
Here.
I'm out of here.
You're out of here. You're in the south of France.
Patrick, you got room for me there?
Sure, no problem. Coming over.
Do you have anything like Mint in France?
No, I looked, and we don't. The banks all have online services, but nothing like Mint. Yeah. And I even tried opening an account with Mint and was all happy when it accepted my opening the account,
But then there was only American banks.
Right. It won't
and
import
then it
any
enforced my anti-American. Right.
Well, it's because this is largely due to the fact that the EU has privacy and security laws that are alien to ours, and they won't let you do that stuff.
This, you know, I mean, talk about a violation of privacy and security. I'm giving them everything.
Yeah.
And you know, I go on my iPhone, you press a button, it tells you what's, you know, what my net worth is, where all my money is.
Yeah. Somebody just says, knock you over the head with a sack of pennies and then grab your iPhone and they got your balance sheet.
There's another thing that people don't quite realize about Mint and Quicken, which is there's a much bigger story, which is that Intuit actually runs a lot of the online banking for banks in the US already.
Oh, interesting.
So they actually are a service provider. And so, you know, this whole issue of Mint actually used a thing called Yodlee as the back end. Intuit is actually a pretty big deal in actually hooking up to banks. So
is Yodlee an Intuit competitor as well?
Sort of. Yodlee's actually been around for a long time. They were in late 90s, they were around, and they were trying to do what Mint is doing today. They actually had a thing that was a bit like NetVibes or PageFlakes, but also with all your financial information in it.
Wow.
And they then turned themselves into a B2B company. They do actually still provide the B2C bit, but Mint really came along and did a great job of it. But Intuit has been building this business in the back end, which is all of the bank connectivity.
Now, I wonder if they'll abandon Yodlee and make Mint use Intuit someday. Because I have to say, one of the reasons I loved Mint was I never got Quicken to do a very good job of importing all my data. I had to do a lot of by hand tweaking and stuff. And Mint just does it automatically. It categorizes
it. I'm surprised you haven't got banks of bookkeepers.
I do, actually.
Okay. I just haven't been there on a Tuesday, I suppose.
They come in on Tuesday and they count my money for me, and then we have a little vat that we keep it all in.
You got that little thing that flips through the dollars. Yeah.
It's just like that.
Yeah.
Just like that. Hey, I really want to thank you all for being here, and I especially want to thank you, Patrick, and John Graham coming for staying up so late with us. Patrick Béja is a podcaster from Paris. His site is frenchspin.com. And will you do return the favor and allow me to be on your show at some point?
Absolutely, that would be a great pleasure.
I'd love to.
Do you
be
watch
on the
movies at all? You could be on the Movielicious.
I do. Maybe you have is that an English language one as well? Movielicious.
Yes, it is.
Is it? Do you talk about movies? You review movies?
Yeah. Well, I'm reluctant to say review because it really implies a level of professionalism that we don't really have, but we discuss the movies that we've just seen.
Modern movies.
And sometimes trash them.
You know what I loved? I just saw as Inglourious Bastards.
You liked it?
Oh, yeah.
It was a great
movie. You know why? Because Hitler gets it in the end. I don't think I'm spoiling anything when I say.
Well, I think we have come to some understanding that Hitler actually did die.
Yeah, but not the way it shows it in the movie.
Not that way.
No. It's really kind of... It's Maybe Quentin Tarantino, so it's very, very violent.
Or you think they're revealing the absolute truth, though? I mean, is it possible?
Maybe this is what really happened.
This could be. It could be a cover-up for what really happened.
It's actually, as violent as it is a comedy. It's very funny.
All his violence has been comedic.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I mean, that one that
Reservoir Dogs. Oh, Kill Bill.
Well, Reservoir Dogs, I don't think he really had the soft touch with that one. But with the Kill Bill, when that girl chops off the woman's head and then the blood squirts up like a little geyser that goes
so
on
horrible.
Forever.
It's so horrible.
It's so ludicrous.
Does have
it was
a talent
ridiculous.
For making gruesome stuff sort of funny.
I think you need to get John and me on. Have you done Inglourious Basterds yet?
No.
We have.
Oh,
but I'm sure we'll find some.
Oh, you got to go see it. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll watch it.
Because of the World War II history.
I'll watch it on the 100-inch screen at home.
Oh, shut up. You have a 100-inch screen?
You know what you should see, though?
Did you buy that?
It's a projector.
Oh.
Go ahead, Patrick.
No, I just wanted to mention the movie 500 Days of Summer.
Oh, is that good?
Amazing.
Oh, I have to go see that.
Amazing movie. Everyone, please go out and see it. And that's all I'll say about it.
500 Days of Summer, yeah. Well, you know, I love, what's her name? Chloe, what's her name?
Zooey Deschanel.
Zooey Deschanel, I'm in love with
her. 500 Days of Summer is about global warming?
Yeah. Very good. Very quick. Thank you for being here, Patrick. We really appreciate it.
Thank
also,
so
want to thank my friend, John Graham Cumming, and I really want to thank you for the great job you did rehabilitating and bringing people's awareness to the great injustice that was done to Alan Turing.
That was great.
Yeah. Success.
Thanks very much.
Don't forget his book, a must read, Geek Atlas. It's on Amazon. It's available everywhere from O'Reilly and Sons. His website, jgc.org. Thanks for staying up late with us, John.
Yeah, no problem. Nice talking to you.
And John C. Dvorak, We appreciate your great contributions as always.
You can find me at channeldvorak.com and on Twitter. I am The Real Dvorak, spelled T-H-E-R-E-A-L Dvorak, D-V-O-R-A-K, D-V-O-R-A-K, if I can get that right.
And he has never mentioned David Pogue on Twitter.
I've never mentioned David Pogue and really had no desire to until now, which I did mention him in a Twitter asking people to give me the where I mentioned him, and somebody on Twitter, my audience, somebody said, here it is. And
Twitter's a great crowdsourcing tool.
It is. I love it.
Love it.
In fact, I don't know if I could do it. I'm at the limit where, you know, if you crowdsource with 60,000, it's harder than you know, 30 because you start getting a lot of results. Too much redundancy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for being here, John. We really appreciate it. Thank you all for being here. East Meets West is coming up next. Remember, you can watch this show live every Sunday afternoon, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. But make sure you subscribe on iTunes or the Zune store as well, because those subscriptions make us lots more money, frankly, than you watching on the stream. Did you know that?
I'm glad for you.
We make no money on the stream.
Well, the stream is just...
It's just floating out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another twit.
This is amazing.
It's hit the can.
It's hit the can? You said
it's in the can.
You said hit the can.
It's hit the can. Don't go. We're not done yet because David Pogue joined us right before the show. I asked David on. Actually, he asked to be on, and I was very glad to have him on, to rebut our conversations about him and the conflicts of interest that we considered were happening at the New York Times with his coverage, and particularly of Apple. So David agreed to a call in from the road. He's in Syracuse, and the conversation went something like this. David Pogue is here with us, and just to kind of set this up, over the last couple of weeks, we've been pretty hard on David, which is hard for me because I consider David a friend, and I really like you, David. But we've been very hard, and I know you've received criticism in other areas as well, because the New York Times public editor responded to a conflict of interest issues. In particular, the public editor responded to the issue of you reviewing Snow Leopard while at the same time writing a book on Snow Leopard, which might lead one to think that you have some vested interest in the success of Snow Leopard. And then I think we were more critical in general of the fact that as time's gone by, you've become more and more apparently a Mac fan, and that it just seemed like it was inappropriate for the Times to use you as a reviewer because it just didn't seem like, you know, you were unbiased in the issue. So I wanted to give you, is that fair? Is that a fair summary of what you feel like we've been saying about you?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
So I wanted to give you a chance to respond. Absolutely. And,
well, sure.
And I do want to say up front, I think the world of you, David. You're super talented. I really admire you. I don't believe that you're, that you would in any way act unethically. And I hope that wasn't the feeling that you got from this, but I do think that there is an issue, and it's a different issue than perhaps somebody like me who's a podcaster, who's an opinion person, that because you write for the Times, you have a higher standard to adhere to.
Well, I think you're right. I think there is clearly an apparent conflict of interest. But what I thought was interesting about your segment with the panelists to talk about me when I wasn't there, is that I think you had Dwight Silverman, right, from the Houston Chronicle?
Well, it happened several times. So last week it was Jason Calacanis on Twit. And then the week before, I believe it was Dwight Silverman.
Right.
And Dwight, I think, was defending you because he, in fact, also writes books about these topics.
Right. In point of fact, this is a problem with the industry and not so much with me alone. And this is what I wanted to bring up to you. It's about context. So Dwight admitted to you that he writes for the Houston Chronicle, and he wrote a Windows book at the same time that he was writing about Windows for the paper.
Right.
And Ed Baig, who is writes for an even bigger newspaper than I do. He writes for USA Today, the equivalent column. He wrote Macs for Dummies, Palm Pre, The Missing Manual. He wrote an iPhone book. At the same time, he was reviewing those. Walt Mossberg for the Wall Street Journal makes, I think the New Yorker said, $1 million a year off of the D conference,
right,
where Steve Jobs and Bill Gates make exclusive appearances, the very guys whose products he reviews. So it's a growing problem. You'd probably have a hard time finding someone who doesn't have a problem like this. So, I'm not going to say there's no visible conflict of interest. Obviously, there is one. The question is, the only thing I can say in my defense, our defense, is does that conflict of interest affect the writing? Does it affect the conclusions? So, in other words, can you look at a column I've done about some Apple product and say, oh my gosh, this thing that he has a book about is so much more of a positive review than any of the other national reviewers gave him? And
well,
I don't think
I can. So let me.
You can?
Yeah, let me bring that up. So, okay. And this is where, to be honest with you, for a long time I've been aware of the conflict of interest, and you're right, it is endemic, and I think it's a big problem. But we can, and well, let's talk about that because I think it's a good subject. But let me talk specifically about you first. So, where it really started to surface for me as an issue was your Snow Leopard review, which was a very positive review, and left out what I thought was something fairly critical. You talked in a blog posting, and I'm trying to remember who you talked to, about some significant problems you'd had with Leopard.
But Leo, there are two paragraphs about the glitches in the review. That's what boggles my mind.
Mention the fact that you never got CS3 working, that your printer never did work. It felt to me like you downplayed the glitches. That it was, and in my opinion, I realize I was swimming upstream on this because you're right. Most of the national reviewers were very positive about Snow Leopard. I was much more critical of Snow Leopard, and really felt that. That the tech reporting had done a disservice to Apple users by recommending the upgrade when, in fact, I don't think it was ready for most people. The problems that it caused did not outweigh the benefits that people were going to get.
But I must disagree with you about that. I specifically, in the New York Times, mentioned Microsoft Word, Photoshop CS3, the FTP program that was crashing all the time, and a couple of other, I named them specifically.
Okay.
And so when Paul from VentureBeat emailed me and asked me to elaborate, I said, I named the exact same problems, except for the printer one, which happened later. Later, I was not able to, after the review for the Times was done, I was not able to connect to my HP laser printer, which turns out is because they took out Apple Talk, and it's pretty easy to fit back in. You just switch it to IP address. And so really wasn't an incompatibility. As a matter of fact, the Word problem went away as soon as I did a reinstall. I think my normal template was corrupted. That turned out, as far as I know, not to be a Snow Leopard thing at all. The Photoshop CS3 crashes, other people have had. Adobe's talked about it a lot on their website. And supposedly that was corrected, as I predicted, by the 10.6.1
right.
Update from Apple. So you're wrong. I did not mention that in the Times. In fact, I mentioned the same things except that I mentioned to VentureBeat. And the reason it was only two paragraphs was because these things always happen when something new comes along, and then there are bugs, fixes, and patches, and they go away. I said exactly the same thing about the Microsoft Zoom the following week. There were little glitches, and I'll say the same thing again this week about the product I'm reviewing now that's brand new with a 1.0 operating system.
Okay. I will, point taken. I felt the tone of the, I won't defend it, but I felt the tone of the Snow Leopard review was more positive than I would have given it, but that's a difference of opinion.
You had problems, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And significant ones. And I feel like, in general, people should have been a little harder on Snow Leopard. The second issue that came up was, your conversation with Steve Jobs right after the Apple event. Where to your credit, you immediately asked the question everybody was asking, why no camera? Steve gave you a pretty spinny answer, and I was hoping for more follow up there. And I wonder if the impression I got was that perhaps you were reluctant to challenge Steve.
Well, see, that was a really bizarre situation, first of all. By the way, what did you think of Walt Mossberg's interview with Jobs and Ed Begg's interview with Jobs the same day?
I didn't actually read them. I read you,
yeah, David. Because they didn't write them. They didn't write them at all.
Well, so did you have an? So that was unclear to me. Did you not have an exclusive? Ed and Walt did get interviews with
him. No, all the big guys had interviews, one right after another. We were all sitting in the
and
same.
And why do you think they didn't write them?
So I think Apple clearly wanted to focus on the products. So they declined every Times and Wall Street Journal and USA Today reporters, business reporters' requests for interviews. So only the product guys got in, and not the business interviewers. So my editors asked me, by the way, we'd like to do a news story about this. While you're there, can you ask these newsy related questions? And we'll use quotes from it for a business story. And they gave me some questions that they hoped that I would pass along. So, you know, you have 10 minutes with the man, and already after this, John Dvorak went on Twitter and said, David Pogue is a disgrace to journalism. Jason Calacanis said, no one in the tech business takes you seriously. It's a joke that the New York Times employs you. They're just unbelievably harsh. And one guy on the David Pogue blog said, you should have nailed Jobs' ass to the wall. And I'm kind of like, dude, that is not how you get. I mean, yeah, maybe I should have. But is that my job? Let me ask you this, Leo. What would you have said if he spun you? If he said, well, the reason we didn't put a camera in the iPod Touch is because we're repositioning it as an inexpensive game machine. And you didn't buy it. So what would you, let's role play.
Not to laugh when he said that. Now, I've talked to Steve, and I know that the follow-up question, which I would have said is, I'm not sure exactly what I've said, but I would have said, well, Steve, that doesn't make any sense. He would have left. And this is the issue I think that a lot of trade press has, and press that covers narrower fields have, and certainly it's a problem in the Beltway, with balancing access with fairness.
Now we're talking. That's the point. He would have left.
And I got to tell you, that's why I have never been offered an interview with Steve Jobs, although I've asked many times. It's why I was never allowed to speak to Bill Gates, because every time you have to speak to Bill Gates, you have to submit questions in advance. And I, for ethical reasons, don't believe I should be doing that. So I don't get those interviews. I will never get an interview with Steve Jobs. I think perhaps because, in fact, I wasn't even invited to that event. Perhaps because I have not been a Apple cheerleader in recent times. And I think that is an issue, David.
So I think now it's on the table. So is it better to ask the hard questions and not nail his ass to the wall on the follow-up, but bring the readers his answers? Or is it best not to interview him at all and get no answers? Listen, and by the way, I want to add, this isn't a David Pogue, Steve Jobs thing.
No, I agree.
I have interviewed Bill Gates. Was not asked to submit my questions in advance. I have interviewed senators, interviewed governors for CBS Sunday Morning. I interview lots of big people, and I'm always respectful. That doesn't mean I'm kissing their ass. It means you're respectful. I asked him the tough questions. It came out later that, you know, the blogs found a hole in the iPod Touch where someone could have put a camera. But that happened after the fact.
Had you seen that before the interview?
That came out two or three days later.
But no, I'm saying if you had, would you have brought it up?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So that's really the issue. I'm not saying be disrespectful, but I think that it is an issue when, in effect, you're giving Apple... Look, you're coming from the New York Times. You're giving an Apple a platform for what is essentially public relations, a press release. And so I think that there is an issue there. I think that because you have the weight of the New York Times behind you, I'm certain that's why Bill Gates did not ask you to submit questions when he asked me to submit questions. You have some weight, and you can go in there and perhaps challenge him a little bit more. And I know that's a difficult thing to do, but I think it's your job.
Well, I'll accept that. I objected to most about John Dvorak's tearing me down on Twitter is you're a disgrace to journalism. Since when have I ever billed myself as a journalist?
And that's the question, David. If you were a blogger, I mean, are you a blogger for the New York Times? I mean, you have a blog. If you were a blogger, nobody would say this. It would say, or an opinion. Let's not say blogger. Let's say a columnist, an opinion person. You know, nobody says to David Brooks, why is it that you aren't a fan of President Obama? Actually, I guess he is. But I mean, you're not a columnist. You're a reporter, or are you not?
No. I, by the way, I'm suddenly realizing this is all just making it all worse for myself. But I just, I got it. That the haters are going to hate David Pogue.
They're going to, you know, you can't win with the haters.
I am not a reporter. I have never been to journalism school. I don't know what it means to bury the lead. Okay, I do know what it means. But I'm not a reporter. I've been an opinion columnist my entire career. I express opinions. I try to entertain and inform. And in this instance, and I've never, never interviewed Jobs in this sort of news reporty way before. And it was a mistake. I don't think I'm not an investigative reporter by any means. And it, again, this is not a Jobs thing. This is a David Pogue thing. I like my interview subjects to like me. I like them to feel comfortable because in my experience for CBS Sunday Morning, the interview subjects tend to be more forthcoming. They tend to let things roll more when they feel comfortable as opposed to feeling, you know, feeling that they're being.
David, that's my style, too. So I'm completely sympathetic. I think one of the reasons we get along, I'm not a confrontational journalist. So maybe that's a misapprehension about your role at the Times. And certainly you were put in the position of being a news reporter. It's now, what is the Times reaction to this? I mean, I read the public editor's piece. It sounded like they were content with your role. And from now on, they're going to put a disclaimer in your column. Is that the end of it?
I don't know. You know, as the public editor said, I was already doing the missing manuals when the New York Times came along. And from the very beginning, that was my offer. Look, I have to keep doing the books. Right. That's how I put food on the table.
Right.
So anyway, so they went into it with their eyes open. For 9 years, it's never been an issue. Apart from the snarky bloggers, most readers seem satisfied that I'm being even-handed. And if you, again, if you compare my review, you know, I called Mobile Me a mobile mess. I said that iMovie 08 was a train wreck. I mean, I'm not afraid to and I had books on those subjects. So I'm not afraid to nail Apple where it's due because why wouldn't I? It's my credibility is my bread and butter. People think I'm, you know, going to cave just to increase the sales of my books, which, by the way, I think is a pretty, it's pretty far-fetched. You know, oh, David Pogue's doing this to get his 80-cent royalty.
No, anybody who's written a book knows that.
Yeah. So so as far as I know, that's it for the Times. I've offered repeatedly. I mean, we've discussed this a lot over the years, and I've offered repeatedly to take those weeks off.
Right.
You know, I only have three missing manuals, right? So iPhone, macOS 10, and Windows. Those are the three that I'm keeping alive. So it comes up three times a year, this subject. So I've said I could take those weeks off from the Times. You could get someone else to write it. Their feeling is that at this point, readers are sort of expecting my voice and they know me. And I've frequently said, why don't we disclose the book in the column? And so for 9 years, that's been shot down because it's like, dude, you can't advertise yourself. It's like putting a plug in the column. Right. So they never did that before. Now
that is
now
the irony is the disclaimer is in a way a plug, isn't it?
That's right. And you know what? I'm sorry to tell you guys this, but now that the plug is going to appear in each column, it's going to raise the book sales.
Right, right. Let me ask you about the video, the I Love My iPhone video. A lot of people have said, look, this is a proof positive that David is a fanboy. He shouldn't be reviewing any Apple products after making a video that says, I love my iPhone.
Wait, you're talking about the song that goes, I want to touch its precious screen.
That one.
I want to wipe the smudges clean.
Yeah, that one.
I want my friends to look and drool. I want to say, look, now I'm cool. I took a stand, paid half a grand. That one? The one that goes,
yeah.
Talks about the, it's got no
So you're
key.
Saying it's a parody. It's not a pain to the iPhone. It is, in fact, mocking it.
Of course. Okay. It was a parody of the hype, dude. Okay. I mean, it's so obvious.
All right.
We went to all these guys who've been standing in line for the Apple store for a week, you know, 1,000 people and got them to sing the lines. One whole verse is about, you know, no keys, no memory card, can't expand it, can't change the battery. A whole verse about that.
Yeah, but all anybody remembers
is, never mind.
I love my iPhone. That's all anybody remembers of it.
Well, evidently, but watch the whole thing. It's a parody of the whole thing.
Okay.
Look, dude, like it's my credibility at stake. I'm not going to say if I really did kiss Apple's ass, I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't advertise it.
That's a good point. That's probably a bad way to go if you had something to gain.
Just one last thing. I know we've hammered this horse till it's dead, but one last thing is, I'm not an Apple fanboy, meaning that I give Apple a pass. However, I think that Apple is relatively more often likely to do polished work. What's interesting to me is that nobody nails me for being a Google fanboy or a BlackBerry fanboy or a TiVo fanboy or a Sonos fanboy. All of those companies have gotten a higher percentage of positive reviews from me than Apple. It's because Apple and Microsoft are part of this religious war that people care, and they get especially fired up about this. But I think it's important not to mix up the two. The haters want me to cream Apple every time.
Right.
You know, that's not going to happen. I'm going to give good reviews when it's deserved and bad reviews deserved. Just like a theater critic may generally like Sondheim's work. A restaurant critic may generally like chef, you know, Pierre Boulez's work or whatever. I think that Apple, and so do you, Leo, I think I've heard you say many.
I'm in that category, yeah.
In general, they do polished, elegant work. Yep. And I'm going to call it when I see that.
So what do we do then about the issue that you raised at the beginning, which is, I think, a big issue, which is that it's very difficult to find people that there isn't a conflict of interest to cover this stuff. I mean, I've tried personally to distance myself from PR. I very rarely take products for review anymore. I buy the products that we review. I've done everything I can to distance myself from that. And I don't work for the New York Times or the Houston Chronicle. Is it too late to expect a higher standard? Is it impossible to find a reviewer that doesn't have conflicts of interest?
Consumer Reports?
Yeah. That's actually been my model as going forward, is to try to move towards that standard. They don't take advertising either, which makes it very difficult for me because
I don't want to be Michael Arrington and get you really pissed off here, but
the Palm Prix, I took a loaner of that, okay? But that's very rare. That was a rare exception, and there were logistical reasons why I did that. Because they released it on Saturday, I didn't have time to review it at the radio show. I wouldn't have been able to buy it in time. So I did take a loaner. But generally, if I can buy something before the radio show, including all the iPhones I own, all the Macintoshes I own, I will buy them, trying to keep my distance. I don't get invited to these events anymore. And I think it's because I don't take calls from PR. I don't do vendor meetings whenever possible. Again, I recently did one for the Zune HD, foolishly hoping to get it in time for the for a review, but that didn't work out because they didn't activate the dang thing. So I try as much as I can to do that. And I think that that's something we should ask of tech reporters, don't you?
Well, except that as a result, you're depriving your readers of your opinions a lot of times, or delaying them. I mean, is that good too?
Yeah, I think that that's a worthwhile trade-off. Because you're in print, you have a longer lead time. I don't have the lead time that you do.
Right.
But as a result, I often have to give a quote first look review because I don't have much time to look at it when the product's released. I think that that's fair. It's what I'm comfortable with, David. I don't really want to have a relationship with these companies.
Right.
My job is to represent the user. And if I am too close to the companies, it makes it hard for me to do my job. I like these people. And that's the problem. I don't want to like Steve Jobs too much or anybody at Apple too much, because then it would make me hard for me to be honest.
Well, it's extremely admirable what you're doing. It's also extremely unusual in this day and age.
Well, I'm not. I mean, and I apologize for bringing it up because I'm not trying to toot my own horn here. How do we address this as a business?
So my message is, it's not just me. I felt like I was ganged up upon, and I just want to point out it's problematic, but it's not just me.
No, absolutely not. I'd agree with
you. The only solution is, this genie is never going back in the bottle, not with newspapers crashing the way they are. We all need to earn a living somehow. So the experts in this field tend to be in demand for speaking, for television, for books, for newspaper, for blogs, for Leo's show. I mean, they're the same people who are going to recur. So it's not going to change. So it remains, I think, up to the readership to judge if this guy is credible or not, despite what appear to be conflicts.
I guess in the new age, that's the bottom line anyway, because while today I can say, well, you write for the New York Times, so you have a higher standard, the truth is, it's a level playing field. It's increasingly level playing field. And why should anybody have a higher standard? We should all have a high standard. So I guess in the you're right. The bottom line is we're all going to be faced with this. You can't ask a blogger not to get products for review. They can't afford to buy these products.
I mean, in my case, Leo, I think the simple solution would be those three times a year when I have to review a product where I also have a book coming out, that I let a substitute do it. But you know what? That would not change the haters
no,
one
I know.
Iota.
No, that I know also.
That would not satisfy Jason and Dvorak, those guys.
David, I really appreciate your willingness to come on and talk. I apologize for not having you on in the last 2 weeks, but the truth was I didn't know that this would come up as a conversation, certainly not to the degree that it did, or I would have. But I'm really glad you could come on today and talk about
it. Well, thanks for letting me speak my piece. And you're right. It's an interesting question. It's a troublesome question.
And it's only going to get worse.
It's only going to get worse. And already it's been in place for, 15 years, even right. before I came along. So
I grapple with this because I have to do ads, and we can't support it. I wanted to support ourselves like Consumer Reports does with donations, and we just couldn't. There wasn't enough money in it. So we have to do ads, and that raises a huge conflict of interest.
Right. I remember I was listening to your show one day, which is fantastic. And
thank you.
There was a Go to My PC ad.
Right.
And you read the copy, but then you threw in, we use it all the time.
Right.
And
which
I was wondering to myself, I know it's true, but would you mention it every week if they weren't a sponsor?
No, absolutely not. Those are ads. And this is not necessarily effective, but here's the line I've drawn. We don't do ads for products I don't use. Now, in the tech sphere, I'm hoping, I pray, that sometime we'll be getting advertisers who aren't in the tech sphere. Then it won't matter. Because it won't be products I cover. I also recuse myself from coverage of those categories. Fortunately, there's not really much of an issue in terms of Citrix or Audible or Drobo. We don't have, one of our hosts was a wonderful guy. I really adore him. Frederick on our photography podcast, and he was on Mac Break Weekly, took a job with Drobo. I immediately had to let him go or say, you can't do the show anymore. We try to only use journalists, not PR or marketing people on the show. These are the lines I try to draw. But you're right, David. It's very difficult. And increasingly with our hosts, it's impossible. So I think you're right. I think it's ultimately, as with everything else, it's going to the burden is on the reader. The truth is it's always been on the reader. It's just now surfacing as something more explicit.
Yeah.
David, thank you.
Thanks for letting me have the chance to express my side.
Have a great time in Syracuse.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care. David Pope. Bye-bye.